I will call to order the Friday, March 3rd, 2017 meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. We do not, as of this time, have a quorum yet, so I'm going to hold off on officially moving the bill before the committee. But Representative Chair Erdahl, we are going to start with your bill this morning, and we'll take care of other duties here in front of the committee as we get the quorum here. So, Chair Erdahl, I'm going to ask you to start explaining your bill, House File 149, for the committee, and we'll move it just as soon before the committee officially, just as soon as we get a quorum, sir.
All right.
Welcome to the committee, Chair Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great to be here today. Appreciate the opportunity to present this bill to you. House File 149 establishes a school finance task force to recommend changes to Minnesota's school funding system. Now, if we were, the presumption is this, if we were a brand new state and starting over tomorrow, how would we fund our schools? Now, there are a myriad of current formulas, all kinds of ways that we try to fund our schools, and it's confusing. I don't know that it's efficient. And the premise here is that maybe we can do better. Maybe we can't. Maybe we actually have the best system possible. I don't think so. But if that's true, then it is. But I want us to look at ways that we can do it better in the future if we were starting over. I can remember when I was first elected back in 2002 and when I was teaching at New London Spicer, and I got these books from the caucus on how we fund our schools, and I opened it up and I saw all these formulas and all of this, you know, different gobbledygook to me. Brought it to our superintendent and said, "Would you explain this to me?" And he says, "I can't." So if you have a lot of high level people in education who are having trouble, and it hasn't gotten much better. So all I'm saying is, let's form a task force. It's not, this isn't with the thought that, oh, we've never done this before. I think over the years there have been task forces that have looked at this from different angles. I think we should do it one more time at least from maybe a little bit different perspective and from, you know, the current realities and see if we can do a better job. So that is what I am proposing.
Representative Rudolph, thank you. I see you have a testifier. We'll take Mr. Lundell. If you want to go ahead and officially state your name for the record, who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education. And as someone who's been involved in education policy for the last 30 years, I've watched a lot of the gobbledygook being produced, and I'll have to admit to being guilty to helping create some of that gobbledygook. I really think that what Representative Erdahl here is doing is very pertinent. We have studied the formulas in the past, but I do think this is a legislative initiative. Most of the other task forces have come from the Department of Education and other parts of the education system. I've worked on a lot of those task forces, and I will say that every time we have one of those task forces, it does produce good work. I think the other thing I think here is that a lot of people look at these task forces as it's going to be one set of districts ganging up on another set of districts, and I don't think that's the what Representative Erdahl is after at all. He's trying to create a system that's going to create a strong basic formula that would look at how all students are treated, but then also look at the categorical formulas and how they are working and are they meeting the goals that they are set out to do. So I think that this is a very good effort. We're certainly supportive of it in Schools for Equity and Education. And so I will stand for any questions that you have.
Mr. Lindell, thank you for your testimony. Members, we do have a quorum at this time. I'm going to officially move House File 149 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Members, questions for the bill author at this time or Mr. Lindell? Representative Nelson, followed by Representative Pugh.
Thank you, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've not served on the education committees on my time here in the House, but I do remember, I think once in Representative Erdahl, to my first or second term, that Representative, former Representative Atkins talked about that he thought there's only like 7 people that understood the education finance system in the state of Minnesota, and he claimed to be one of them because he had done a study of this as part of his doctoral in college. So I know it's a confusing system and it's a complex system, but it's trying to get at the equities or inequities and judge where the need is for to spend the money so we spend it efficiently so everybody has a fair chance at a good education. And I guess it's not a bad idea to go back and examine and look at things as long as we go in without a preconceived notion that we're going to blow it up or not. And it doesn't sound like that's what Representative Erdahl is planning on wants to do.
Blowing stuff up is a later bill that we have, Representative Nelson. Other member questions? Representative Pugh? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to thank Representative Erdahl for bringing this bill. As a member who has never served on education, representing 4 diverse school districts, every time I hear something more about the education, whether it's the formula or really anything with regard to funding, it's so complicated. Whether it's nonpartisan staff, whether it's partisan staff, the summary statement is, this is so complicated. And so I put an exclamation point and echo Representative Nelson's comments that just I'm really pleased to see us addressing this. I think it'll heighten awareness of really what we do in Minnesota. And I agree with you that there has to be a better, more transparent, easier to understand way to fund education in Minnesota. So thank you.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question in the first paragraph where the last sentence states, the task force may also examine other areas of Minnesota's school funding system. Can you give me some examples of what that might be?
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandstead, I think one of the things that we can look at is composition of funding as well as amount of funding. The balance of property taxes versus state aid, for instance, that might be something that this task force could look at, because one of the things that happened in 2001 when the state took over the basic formula, it's kind of put the property tax back into the system, but in a very haphazard manner, and I think that could be something that this task force would look at. That's something that we're very interested in our organization as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Other member questions at this time? Is there anyone from the public or others who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 149. Anyone wishing to testify or share on 149? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Erdahl will give you the final word on the bill this morning.
Well, just thank you very much for your attention to this matter. Look forward, I hope, to getting some things done in the interim regarding how we fund our schools.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I will renew my motion that House File 149 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, the motion carries. Representative Erdahl, you are on your way.
Thank you. I can find my
team. Representative Quam, we're going to take your bill. Again, we're in the season where people are coming and going from different places. So, Representative Quam, we'll take House File 1855. Members, as we are looking in our packets for House File 1855, and as Representative Quam is getting ready, Representative Freiberg, have you had a chance to review the minutes from yesterday's meeting of March 17th, 2007?
I did, and they were scintillating. I'd like to move approval.
Wow, we've got we are on fire here today. With that, Representative Freiberg moves the minutes from March 2nd, 2017. Any questions, deletions? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Quam, if you want to move your bill before the committee, and it will be being re-referred to the State Government Finance.
Thank you, Member Chairs. I would like to move House File 1855 to be re-referred to State Government Finance.
Proceed with the bill, Representative.
Thank you. It's a short agency technical bill with a name clarification, a updating of a name, and then allowing for public access the data that's paid for out of the Clean Waters funds with the same restrictions as any other, data if there's something private that ends up showing up there that we need to protect or, in other statutes. But otherwise, it's a pretty straightforward, clean bill. There are no treats because legislature did not give the agency funds in order to, give you treats. So it is what it is.
Members, questions for Representative Quam. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's more a question for the chair and staff. I don't see any cost in this bill. I'm wondering why we're sending it to finance and not just directly to the floor from here. Is there a reason for that, or was it requested by state
Representative government? Nelson, my understanding is it was requested to be part of the state government finance omnibus, so I think they're working on some other minute-related things over there, and they wanted to see this, and that way we can maybe be a little more efficient with floor time. That's my thoughts.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions for the bill author? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak to the business before the committee, House File 1855? Anyone wishing to speak on House File 1855? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Quam will give you the final word this morning, sir.
Pretty simple, straightforward. Offer your support.
I will renew the motion that House File, Representative Quam renews the motion that House File 1855 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion carries. The next bill that we will be doing today is Representative Tice. House File 792. Representative Tice, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to move your bill before the committee, and it will be being sent to the Committee on Jobs and Energy.
Mr. Chair, they don't believe it needs to be sent there, so we're thinking it should go to the General Registry. We've got jobs already, and I think the only reason we would go back is if there was a fiscal note, and we haven't seen anything.
Well, then we'll send it to the General Register, knowing that if there is an issue, it will be re-referred there to the Jobs Committee. That's fine. If it's already been through there, I don't see a need for it to go back. We can move to the General Register, knowing that, again, if we have to do a motion to re-refer, we'll have to take care of it at that point. Trying to run efficiently as we can here today. So then if you want to move to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 792 to the General Register. This bill has taken quite a nice path. We originally started out just to be compatible with federal conformity. We just want federal conformity, and what Minnesota did was deviate from that, and what it deviated from was the definition of townhome that would include twin homes. And when you're in the building industry, twin homes and townhomes are very different. And so what we want to do is just get back to that. And for brevity, I'm just going to turn it over to Ms. Stone.
Ms. Stone, welcome to the committee. Go state your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Tice for taking this circuitous path to get a definition change done. I guess the only thing that I really want to mention to you today is that we have found a meeting of the mind with the Department of Labor and Industry and with the Fire Service on a definitional change. And rather than putting in statute the definition of townhome, something that is currently in the building code, we concluded that it would be best that this be done through a rulemaking process. So the reason why the bill is before you is because the bill was amended to allow for expedited rulemaking. If you have questions about the underlying policy, we certainly can get to that. The one thing that I did want to underscore with everybody is that we did talk at length with the Department of Labor and Industry about whether a fiscal note is necessary, and from the Department of Labor and Industry, Deputy Commissioner Jessica Luman, it's my understanding that DLI does not believe, this is what she says, DLI does not believe a fiscal note is needed on the amendment requiring expedited rulemaking. And I'll turn it over to BJ. I don't have your last name.
Ms. Stone, before we do that, we have a member question, I think. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted more of a comment to Representative Yez. Appreciate the bill and how it is going to really, I think, focus on a lot of, I know there's a lot of border communities that are concerned about it, and just appreciate the author on the bill.
Questions for Ms. Stone? Seeing none, we'll proceed to the next testifier. Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief of the city of Burnsville. I'm here representing the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which has four coalitions, including the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. As Ms. Stone says, we've met and come to an agreement on a moratorium to change the definition to come in line with what the fire code and residential code. We understand that it's created havoc for building officials and fire officials across the state, and we believe it's in the best interest to move this forward. The agreement is that Section 2 would come out, the prohibition, once the moratorium is set in motion. So we hope to get that done as expediently as possible and think that that will be in the best interest of the state. So thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. We have a question, Representative Fiber.
Could you just explain a bit about why sprinklers are, you don't believe, are required in townhomes? I mean, it seems to me like it might be a good idea, like they might improve safety. And
Representative Freiberg, that question to
whoever. I guess the representative of the fire chiefs, I'd be interested in. I mean, obviously sprinklers are intended to prevent fires, so it seems like maybe he might be the good.
Ms. Stone, did you want to start the conversation?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, the issue that arose was that about 10 years ago, twin homes, two-unit single-family homes, were included in the definition of townhomes in the residential building code only. And when we were working through the fire sprinkler mandate, and went through the Court of Appeals decision and the like, it became apparent that everybody was believing that a townhome was three units or more, which is what this, the fire code, the ICC, and all the codes around us have. And twin homes got pulled into that definition. So we're not talking about anything greater than two-unit single-family homes.
Representative Freiberg, does that help with the question?
It still seems like sprinklers might improve safety, so I guess I'd just I'd be interested in hearing why twin homes don't need
then let's direct sprinklers. That question to the fire resources that we have here today. Again, state your name for the record.
Sure. BJ with Fire Chiefs Association. Again, it's really more of a definition issue, and this is related to the appeals court decision and trying to come into conformity with appellate court decision that had to do with the sprinklers, 4,500 square feet and less, came to light the difference in the definitions between twin home and townhome, between the building code and the fire code, and we're trying to get the definition to come in line. The fire code already states that the twin homes don't require sprinklers. The building code is different, and it rolls in some of the townhomes. We do believe sprinklers are important, but we don't believe after that appellate court ruling that this definition is workable and creates a lot of confusion because you have codes fighting against each other, and we believe that cleaning up this definition will make it much clearer for everybody. I think sprinklers in general need to go through the code process as we did before if we think that twin homes need to be sprinklered. It has to do with the appellate court ruling that really brought this to light.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Freiberg, one of the reasons it did come to light is that it's causing an economic issue in that if you talk to Representative Lean, who went home last night, I think, that he's having a major problem in his area. Moorhead is having a big change where they went from 45 permits to two. Just because it's making it a little unaffordable. And what we look at twin homes as being is a more affordable housing unit option. And so we are hoping, and we're seeing this across the state, it's not just in Moorhead, but they're seeing a bigger change because they can go across the border and do the same thing and have it more cost effective. So we're seeing a need to bring up the twin homes. They're used a lot with aging communities as well. I mean, it's a very nice option for folks who are looking for that retirement home. So we're trying to conform to the federal and say, let's do this so that we can get these homes built.
Representative Freiberg. Other member questions at this time? The testifiers, the bill author? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House file, where are we at here? House file 792. The matter that's before the committee. Anyone wishing to testify from the public on House File 792? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Tice will give you the final word.
Thank you. We're just looking to do the right thing and get these twin homes built again so that we can get the housing that's being demanded. Thank you.
Representative Tice renews her motion that House File 792 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Tice, you are on your way. The next bill that we will be looking at is House File 10, and I believe Chair Dean is here. I thought I saw him.
He was up there.
Come on down. Good morning, Chair Dean. I will move House File 10 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Welcome to the committee, sir. We'll ask you to go ahead and proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your time. I know how busy your committee is. So I just want to present House File 10. And I'll do that in a very brief fashion because this is almost identical to the bill that was passed 2 years ago. This establishes, basically it gets us out of MNsure and both the oversight board of MNsure and transfers the majority of the responsibility from MNsure to the federal website. There's a couple of reasons for doing that. Number one is that the functionality of the system is not working, that it has never worked properly, that it does not interface correctly with the federal government. Number two, that it is not financially sustainable as it's supposed to be by federal mandate. It is not able to pay for itself. It has never been able to pay for itself and will not be able to pay for itself. And the state will now be on the hook for the 100% of all of the funds that are not able to be generated by either premiums because the state or the federal subsidy and grants have completely run out. And third is that it is hurting people, that people trying to access health care in Minnesota are not able to do so. If I could, if there's a page that could pass this out or if we could just grab half and half. Chairman and then the committee. That is the, I'm passing out something from the Department of Human Services that shows how MNsure is getting paid for over time. We have over $500 million projected to be surpassed in this biennium if we move forward. The functionality of that site has yet to be gained. And so what you see in the graph that I'm passing out right now is the budget year by year. And you can see if you look at fiscal year 2017 budget, the first is development, operations, MNsure operations in total. What you see that tall bar there is this year, and then if you go ahead to 2019, you see a bar half as tall. That says that MNsure predicts to spend half as much money next biennium than they're currently spending. And that is without any development costs. The General Accounting Agency recently did an audit and found that in all of the areas that they measured MNsure for functionality, they were not fully functional in any of those areas. So we're to believe that they're going to spend half as much money that they're not currently functional, that they're not spending any money on build-out, and that this is somehow going to work. So that the financial sustainability of this program is a major problem. Also, you have to look at why did we do this in the first place? We were told that we would get specific tax advantages for Minnesota if we set up a state-based exchange relative to a federal exchange. Then in 2015, there was a Supreme Court decision that decided that our neighbor to the east, Wisconsin, that didn't do this, gets exactly the same tax advantage that we do, so we pay more for something, and the tax advantages are given to other states. So that effectively, Mr. Chair, members, makes Minnesota, and under technical terms, a chump state, because we agreed to something under one pretext and for advantages, and we are not getting that. So this moves us into that and would put us into basically the same position as Wisconsin, with the exception that we would retain control over the ability for network adequacy, which would not cede to the federal government the ability to tell us where our hospitals had to go and clinics had to go. We would retain that within the state. That's the major portions of the bill, Mr. Chair and members. Be happy to answer any questions that you might have or get information of members if I can't get you the answer right now.
Chair Dean, thank you for your presentation. Member questions, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. My understanding, we had a health care financing task force that was set up to look at this, and they came back with a different recommendation. Why are you going this direction? I mean, my understanding is the recommendation was not to go this way.
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I was also on that task force. I had a great many folks from the legislature and also from industry. That was not a consensus opinion. That was a majority opinion from the larger board. But if you look at the individual pieces, the groups that made up that, they could forward recommendations, but without being able to change those recommendations when it got to a final board. I didn't think it was a very fair way to do that. I've requested all of the votes for the commission that I sat on, and would like to be able to share those with the rest of the legislature as soon as I receive them from DHS and the group that we paid to do the consulting group that facilitated the task force and took the votes and so forth. I think it was over $500,000 that we paid to do that. So I'm requesting those votes and that information so that I can share that with the rest of the legislature. But by no means was that a consensus and certainly not a unanimous position.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what I'm hearing is that Representative Dean didn't agree with the final outcome of the task force, so he wants to go a different direction. But I got another question that, you know, with all the uncertainty going on with the presidential election and what happened in Washington, it sounds, and the reports coming out, that the whole system that we're having in health care and through the Affordable Care Act is going to go away and be changed and be different. And so we're going to change, we're going to go to the federal system that a year from now it may not be there. A lot of uncertainty there. We're going to throw all of our Minnesota citizens that have bought their insurance through the exchange into an uncertainty because we don't know what this how the federal system is going to work for us here, and the federal system might not even be there. So we're just putting uncertainty on top of it, more uncertainty. Why don't we wait and find out what they're going to do at the federal level and come down, because that's going to ultimately just have to make us decide what we're going to do. So where do you stand on that? I mean, it sounds like the whole system is going to change. And from what we're reading in some of the reports in this morning's paper, they came out with their draft of what they're going to do, and it doesn't look like that exchange might even be there. So why are we going to go into something that may not exist?
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that's an excellent question. And if you look at what we have right now with MnSure, we have to deal with healthcare.gov, and we have to do that no matter what. We currently do that. We're going to do that next year, the year after, no matter what we decide, whether this bill passes or doesn't. We're going to have to deal with healthcare.gov as the eligibility determination system, because that's where the taxes go, where you figure out how much money you make and all of that jazz. We wouldn't be one of one state, we wouldn't be one of 30 states, we would be one of 50 states, because that's what everybody has to do right now. So moving forward, if you can imagine four quadrants: high quality, low quality, high cost, low cost. Washington, D.C. is high cost, low quality. Okay, that's one quadrant. Minnesota is high quality, low cost. That's where you want to be. We are the highest quality state of any state in the country for health care. We're among the lowest in cost. So our pitch needs to be to the federal government: if you're going to let three states do what they want, Minnesota needs to be one of the three. If you're going to let five states do what they want, Minnesota needs to be one of the five, because we can lead and not follow. I think we're going to be allowed to have that flexibility, and that's what I'm going to be pushing for, and I would encourage others to do so as well, because I think we're uniquely positioned right now to, instead of paying a higher price for jumping into this pool, I think Minnesota should be rewarded for doing really great things of reaching every single metric of success for Obamacare in 2000. We did that a long time ago, and I think we're in a position to lead and not follow. So I think that's why we really do, we're in a good spot relative to other states, and we have to deal with healthcare.gov no matter what we do with our own exchange.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I heard the Representative Dean say that Washington is high cost, low quality, and we're going to jump into that system. I guess I have some concerns with that, and I'd like a roll call on this bill, Mr. Chair.
Roll call being requested. Other member questions? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe not so much of a question, because I did get to ask Representative Dean questions on this in my last committee, and I'll get another opportunity in my next committee. I get to hear this three times. But I share, as you know, Representative Dean, I share concerns about creating more instability in an already unstable situation. Our goal in Minnesota really should be trying to stabilize the marketplace and not trying to create more questions. So dumping a couple hundred thousand people into the federal exchange rather than trying to make their experience more stable doesn't seem to make sense, particularly with the question of whether or not the federal exchange will continue to even be there. In addition, after we spoke the last time about the county investment in METS, our state and counties have invested a lot in building our eligibility system and making this work and being able to communicate between DHS and our counties that are providing public programs. And I actually heard from some county workers after we had that discussion, and they talked about the value add that METS has been, and the fact that we would essentially be taking people out of the system and not using what we built and what we invested in, and not allowing our counties to continue to use what they've invested in, is creating a great deal of concern for them. So I think that this is not the direction that we need to go. I think we need to go in the direction of stability, not instability. I need to think that we need to go in the direction of backing up the systems that have worked, and the METS eligibility system has really improved functionality for our counties, and they don't want to see this go away.
Other member questions? Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak on the matter before the committee? House File 10. Any members of the public or other testimony on House File 10? Seeing none and hearing none, other member questions? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Dean, we will give you the final word.
Appreciate your support.
A roll call being requested. I will renew my motion that House File 10 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Yes.
Bliss?
Yes.
Freiberg?
No.
Halverson?
No.
Jessup?
Yes.
Mason?
No.
Nash?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Yes.
Samstead?
No.
Swierczynski?
Yep.
West?
Yes.
Youakim?
No.
There being nine ayes and six nays, the motion prevails. The House File 10 will be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate your time.
The next bill that we will be taking up is House File 329. Representative Rarick is here as he's making his way down and getting settled in. Again, House File 329. I will move House File 329 before the committee to be re-referred to the committee, or excuse me, to the General Register. Representative Rarick, welcome to the committee. I have moved House File 329 before the committee to be referred to the General Register. We'll ask you to go ahead and proceed with your presentation on your bill. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want me to give a quick little rundown, or would you like to deal with the amendments first?
I will ask you if there are amendments that you would like to take up right now to get the bill in the shape that you would like. We can certainly take those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to have the A3 amendment moved, please.
The A3 is an author's amendment. Members, in your packet, there are a couple of different amendments, and Representative Rarick would like to offer the H0329A3 amendment. I will move that before the committee to for consideration. To be any questions on the author's amendment? Seeing none. Yes. Oh, Representative Freiberg.
Just wondering, I'm just glancing at this very quickly. It looks like it gets rid of a volunteer fire assistance grant account. I'm just wondering if Representative Rarick could explain why that's a good idea.
We will have him do just that. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we are pulling that section out. I have spoken with the PACS chairs, and they would prefer to see that running through as a separate bill. So that is coming from the revisor's office. I will be submitting that section as its own standalone piece and running that through the tax committees.
Representative Freiberg, follow-up?
Not at this point.
Any other discussion on the A3 amendment, the A3 author's amendment? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wishes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Representative Rarick, the bill is in the form you would like. If you want to proceed with the with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 329 is looking to expand the sales and use of fireworks in the state of Minnesota to the aerial and audible type. In short, firecrackers, bottle rockets, Roman candles, things that would shoot in the air, things that would make noise. At the current time, we're limited to sparkling devices and devices that sit on the ground and just emit sparks. So that's what the expansion would be. Working with a number of groups over the last year, addressing their concerns, we have made some changes to the bill. Last time around, the amount of time would have been restricted. Talking with some groups that would like to have brick and mortar buildings for sales. We looked at that and determined, you know, it would not be very cost effective for someone to have to build a structure with such limited time. So we put a provision in allowing sales and use year round. If you sell for 60 days or less, you can sell out of a tent.
Sure.
If you sell for more than 60 days, you would have to go into a permanent structure that meets fire code. And the vast majority of the temporaries do not even sell for 60 days, so they would be less than that. The one thing that, as I've been getting many comments from people, emails, people talking to me, of the people that contact me that are opposed to this, the main reason they give is this just does not work in my area. And we address that in the bill by allowing the local municipalities, whether it be city, township, or even counties, to ban use and or sales within their jurisdiction. So I do completely understand that there are areas where population densities are tighter than areas where I'm from, and that this just does not work in their area. So we're giving them the ability, but as it currently stands, the places where they would work fine and the people are okay with them, they're not allowed to. So that's the reason for doing this. So I will leave the rest of the testimony up to our testifiers.
Representative Burke, I will bring down the representative from the State Fire Marshal's Office, Mr. Bruce West. Mr. West, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I am Bruce West. I'm the Minnesota State Fire Marshal. And it is the mission of the State Fire Marshal Division for the safety and well-being of the citizens of Minnesota. Each of you have a handout that was handed to you this morning. I'm going to refer to that for a couple of areas. If you look at the Minnesota Fireworks at a Glance handout that you received, there's two areas that I want to talk about this morning. Number one is dollar loss. And remember that fireworks were illegal prior to 2002. So there's the statistic that we have on this fireworks at a glance sheet are prior to 2002 and from 2002 to 2016. And I'm very concerned about the average dollar loss. As you can see, prior to 2002, average $90,000 a year. After 2002, $478,000 on average per year. Secondly, if you flip the sheet over, you're going to take a look at injuries. And this is something that our office is very concerned about. We receive the statistics each and every year on injuries. And two that I'm going to focus on this morning are the 0 to 9 age group and the 10 to 19. And you can see the difference on average prior to 2002 in the 0 to 9 and the 10 to 19 age group. And you can see the difference from the 2002 to 2016 age groups and the increase in the dollar loss on the front page and on the back side, the increase in the injuries on a per-year average basis. For those two reasons that I oppose this bill, and I would stand for questions, but, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Fire Marshal West, thank you for being with us today and sharing your testimony. Before you take off, I'm going to see if there's any member questions for the Fire Marshal. We'll go with Representative Pugh and then Representative Halverson. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Fire Marshal West, appreciate your being here today and for this this visual. It's always helpful to see that. I know that, you know, I would like to ask you what suggestions you have for us should this bill pass as to how we could heighten awareness of Minnesotans about the about these statistics. I mean, obviously, as legislators, we could request and likely gain visibility in our local papers. Knowledge is power, and I would imagine that if we heighten visibility of this, that parents, especially with regard to the statistics you shared of kids, would be much more conscientious. There are so many questions amongst our constituents about what is legal, what isn't, and so I would appreciate any thoughts you have on that.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for that question. I think it would come down to education to the citizens of Minnesota, and that would our division would be part of that. If the fireworks expansion bill passes, our office would obviously be dedicated to try to further that education about safe usage of fireworks.
Representative Pugh, follow up. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this is for this testifier or for the person we hear from next, but we have some pretty good history in terms of the change that was made when we expanded fireworks usage in Minnesota, and it looks pretty dramatic in terms of injury and cost to property. So have you in the Fire Marshal Service done any calculations into or looked at other states when they've expanded fireworks to aerial fireworks in terms of the additional costs that we might be looking at as a state and as a city in terms of our municipalities, in terms of insurance rates, and the impact that we might be expecting if we go to aerial fireworks?
Fire Marshal West.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we haven't looked at specific state by state, but I think there's no doubt, and you'll probably hear further testimony about the additional costs that fire departments will have because of response to fireworks-related incidents across the state of Minnesota.
Representative Halverson, follow-up. Other member questions of Fire Marshal West at this time. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Fire Marshal West, I just have a couple questions. and not pro or not, I'm interested in data. So when we look at sparklers, it seems like sparklers is one of the biggest injury-causing forms of stuff. Do we also keep track of, when I'm looking at the injuries, do we keep track of what kind of fireworks that they were injured on?
Mr. Chair,
Fire Marshal,
committee members, you know, you can see from the bottom side of the document, it's, you know, with sparklers, firecrackers, bottle rockets, you know, the Roman candles. That is the statistics that our office receives, not only from the fire departments, but also from the emergency rooms. So we know specifically what that injury was caused by. So that's the statistic that we cover, or that we gather.
Representative Tice, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Fire Marshal West. And just because I want to make sure I have it absolutely clear, fireworks are the ones you just light on fire and hold, right?
Sparklers?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Sorry, sparklers.
Yep. Committee,
Fire Marshal West.
Committee member, yes, absolutely. Sparklers are, you know, and the issue with the injuries with the sparklers is the heat that sparkler will attain. It's 900 to 1,000 degrees. And at times when a person is done, they'll throw it on the ground or drop it on the ground to grab another one, or they'll light another one from that sparkler that's going, and then somebody may step on it. That's one of the causes of injuries is the fact that they'll throw it on the ground, and it's still hot for a certain amount of time, and they step on it, or some of the sparkler may get on their hands or on a piece of clothing.
Okay. Can I take a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Fire Marshal West. Did we have sparklers before 2002?
Fire Marshal West.
Fire Marshal West.
Mr. Chair, committee member, that, I'll be honest, I don't know. I will have to gather that information and provide it to the committee. So I don't know that one.
Representative Tice, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think I remember sparklers forever, so
yeah.
I'm just kind of,
I don't
I'm
know
not
what,
sure.
at what point, Mr. Chair, but we will provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
Other questions of Fire Marshal West from committee at this time? Fire Marshal West, we'll ask you to kind of stand by in case there are some follow-up questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll bring our next testifier up. And again, you did testify earlier in another bill, but for the record, we'll have you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Driscoll and committee members, I'm BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Burnsville. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which has four fire service organizations, the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshal Association of Minnesota, and the International Association of Arson Investigators Minnesota Chapter. I appreciate you taking my testimony this morning as you deliberate on whether or not to expand fireworks in Minnesota. As a passionate advocate of public safety, we continue to oppose any and all expansion of fireworks as they indisputably cause injuries and fires. This proposed legislation would legalize the recreational use of explosives, also known as fireworks. Using the American Pyrotechnics Association standards, it provides voting membership to commercial users, importers of fireworks, and distributors of fireworks, and manufacturers of fireworks. It does not have representation from the fire service on its standards. The proposed legislation does not account for important safety measures that are currently used with any aerial explosives in Minnesota, such as fallout zones and safety zones, permitting of use, restrictions on weather and wind, insurance and bonds, kill switches, training and certification for the operator, and checking for hot embers after discharging explosives. The ability for local control sounds good, but in the metro that's very difficult, particularly when the city boundaries may be blocks and very close proximity. If one community allows it, the next one doesn't, it's very difficult to enforce those regulations. While we believe these explosives are best handled and discharged by qualified individuals, the Minnesota data that the fire marshal provided is very telling on injuries. We do want to acknowledge that Representative Rarick has directed a portion of the sales tax receipts. I understand that was amended to be a separate bill, but for that money to go towards firefighting equipment in small departments and the fire safety account. While this is greatly appreciated, we can't in good conscience support the bill to legalize recreational use of explosives. We would like to make the statement that make no mistake that these fireworks do injure people and cause property damage. So we'd ask you, why take the chance? We ask you to join a long list of people and organizations that oppose the expansion of fireworks, which includes the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, the League of Minnesota Cities, the State Fire Department Association, the Chiefs of Police Association, and many, many more. And I will stand for any questions you may have.
Member questions for the chief. Representative Halverson followed by Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chief, for your testimony. I often hear here at the legislature about the challenges that we have with our local fire departments in terms of funding and resources, that our local fire departments are under-resourced, understaffed. We are having trouble finding enough volunteers, and we're needing to move to more paid staff. With the increased use of fireworks, it sounds like we will be in a position to need additional firefighters and firefighter resources. Can you comment on that at all in terms of how stretched you guys are now and how that might impact fire departments around the state?
Chief, Committee Chair, Representative. Minnesota has the second highest number of volunteer firefighters in the country. We're the 21st most populated, and we spend 45th out of 50 states on the fire service. And the recruitment and retention challenges that our state continues to have in the fire service are enormous, and anything that exacerbates the demands on the service will continue to put a strain on the recruitment and retention issue, no doubt. It's difficult to get people to volunteer at their local fire department and garner all the training that they need, let alone the cost of all the equipment that's needed to appropriately respond. So, the fire service in Minnesota is very stretched, very thin. It's very efficient, but it definitely has challenges ahead of it that we're feeling now and in the future.
Representative Halverson, follow-up.
Just to say thanks for your service and thanks to the, thousands and thousands of volunteer firefighters. And if the folks who are working so hard to keep us safe have this great a concern, I think that we should heed your words wisely. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question that for either one of you, actually. In my neighborhood, and it goes both before the 4th and after the 4th, there's definitely a lot of evidence that the fireworks are being used. My question is, how difficult is it to enforce or to arrest people? I don't know. Is there arrest for people that are using it inappropriately and to keep everybody safe? And the noise level is just getting to be increased as well along the way. So that's all. Can you enforce the use of fireworks prohibit?
Representative Mason, are you asking the chief to respond to that question? Representative Mason.
Pardon?
Representative Mason, are you asking the chief to respond to that question?
I think probably the fire chief would
okay.
be
Okay, chief?
Chair and Representative Mason, it is very difficult to enforce. I would ask that we ask a law enforcement official, as they're primarily responsible for that. Our enforcement comes in as the fire investigation piece. The fire was caused by that. I know there are challenges with local municipalities law enforcement trying to enforce that, particularly around the 4th of July. But I can't speak to exactly how that works. I know they can issue citations. I don't know about arresting and all that kind of stuff. That would be a question we should refer to the law enforcement community.
Representative Mason, follow-up.
Would the author have any information about that?
I'm sorry.
Representative Rare, same question to you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A year ago when I was working on this, we did some background checks on how many times charges had been filed. There were just a small number of times that charges were actually filed, and we did not see that any of those cases were actually followed through on. I think part of it, in talking to my local sheriff about it, many times when they get the call, by the time they get there, people are done using them. They really don't have any good solid evidence. And with what they're getting out of it, the county attorney doesn't see any point in proceeding with charges. So it has happened in a couple of cases in Minnesota, but it does not happen very often.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mason, any follow-up?
No, that kind of answers the questions. There's little enforcement.
Representative DeJoaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this one might be best directed to the chief. I had the pleasure of hearing this bill a few years ago in here, but I know we have some new members. At the time, they brought in a video about the dangers of having fireworks in tents, and I know you've, Representative Merrick, has capped this to 60 days and under, but that's a pretty good chunk of our summer. So could you maybe touch base a little bit about some of the added concerns of having a tent sale versus a bricks and mortar?
Chief. Chairman, members of the committee. Yeah, we did bring in a video a few years ago of a tent fire down in Florida, fireworks. Obviously, those tents have little fire or no fire suppression and little ability to do anything once that fire starts. So once these fireworks do start on fire, they can obviously turn into a large conflagration that is dangerous to people really quickly. And there's little standards for tent sale, per se, that make it difficult, again, to enforce and keep them from continuing to get more things on fire once they start. So I don't know if that answers it.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think part of the video that really stuck with me the most was the inability for people that were inside purchasing those to get out, because I know there's not a lot of, like, space in between with the tables and the sales and having clear marked exit signs and, like you said, no fire suppression. So that's still a big concern of mine.
Other member questions for the chief at this time? Chief, we'll ask you to stand by as we continue with this. Is there anybody else from the public or other testifiers who'd like to come forward on the matter that's before the committee at this time? House File 329. Sir, please come on up, and we'll have you identify yourself for the record. And again, if others are interested, we'll just ask you to start forming a line, and we'll get you in queue here if you are interested in discussing the matter. Good morning, sir, and welcome to the committee. I ask you to state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Steve Haynes. I'm co-owner of Bear Creek Pyrotechnics. We're a display company. We do commercial fireworks displays. I'd like to take a few moments to tell you a couple of things about how a small business owner would operate some of these tent retail sites. We do shows in Minnesota and Wisconsin. HF 329 gives us an opportunity to grow our business and prosper. Our retail sites are going to be staffed by people who work for us on shows. Some of these people are lead operators. That means that they're licensed by the state of Minnesota to conduct commercial fireworks displays. That means they're trained and educated in the safe handling and lighting of fireworks. Now, we have storage both fixed and mobile that's inspected and approved by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They approve these storages for the storage of commercial fireworks. They're more than adequate for the safe storage of consumer fireworks. Now, a large percentage of the brick-and-mortar retail sites, you'll find that they're lined up along the border, usually along trunk highways, interstates. I live on one of these trunk highways. It's Highway 48. I watch friends, I watch neighbors, I watch strangers driving across the river to buy their fireworks. Not only am I watching tax dollars go away, but I'm watching the growth of my business go away as well. Now, if anybody has any questions for me, I'd be happy to ask.
Thank you, sir. Questions for the testifier? Thank you for being with us today. Anyone else wishing to speak on the matter before the committee? House File 329. There are some amendments that were in our packets. Is there anyone wanting to offer additional amendments today? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I'd like to offer the A5.
Representative Freiberg offers the A5 amendment to House File 329. Representative Freiberg to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of set the context, first of all, I certainly sympathize with the business owners' challenges here, but I think just the statistics speak for themselves. I'm really concerned about the injuries caused by fireworks, so I am not supportive of the bill. I do think if we're going to be considering it and if it's going to be moving on, we should be doing everything we can to make it, to ensure that there are as many precautions in there as possible. So the first amendment I'm offering is the A5. It would limit the sale of the currently prohibited devices only around the 4th of July, so from June 15th to July 15th in a year. I mean, I'm sure there are people now who go across the border, purchase fireworks that aren't legal here and bring them back around that time of the year. So if we're going to be doing this, I think we should just be limiting it to the time where it probably happens the most anyway, which is right around the 4th of July. So I hope people would look favorably on this amendment.
Representative Burick to the amendment as the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I'd be really happy to speak with you more about this one. Last year, this is much closer to what my bill was last year, where we did do this. We restricted the time frame. Talking with groups, I had made a kind of a compromise to go to the brick and mortar. I extended it. So I'm more than happy to keep talking to you about this one that we could look at later. But at this time, I would please ask that we would vote no. But this is one I'm definitely willing to talk to you more about and talk to some of the people within the industry, see if that's okay, if we would go back to that way. That was how I originally had it. I would probably like to go maybe go to June 1st to July 15th if we go back to that.
Representative Freiberg.
Would Representative Rarick consider an amendment to change, an oral amendment to change June 15th to June 1st? Would that make this amendment acceptable?
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd really like to talk with some of the groups that I had worked with before I do that, but I would have a chance to chat with them and see where they stand, see if that's a better approach to take. So I will definitely work with you on that and talk to people about it.
Representative Freiberg and Representative Rarick, I have a question for both of you. One is the author, and one is the of the bill, and the other is the author of the amendment. And as you're taking into consideration how to proceed with this, the amendment says sparkling devices, novelties, and aerial and audible devices. Does that include professional aerial displays?
Mr. Chair, it does not.
That is in a different statute, Representative Rarick? Very good. That helps with my question. Other member questions on the A5 amendment? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just looking at this language, being able to purchase things for a month, and then looking at these statistics where 4 out of the 6 types of fireworks are from currently illegal fireworks, I guess I'm not really sure that it's really going to make any difference when people can drive 20 minutes from here and purchase all these items across the border. And you just heard from the testifier who owns a business here in Minnesota that, amen, you know, it seems like the only thing that this bill would do was penalize the businesses that sell it right now.
Representative Peterson, was that a question or a statement?
It was more of a statement.
Okay. Other member discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign?
No.
Well, not the same sign, no, so thank you. It's been a long week for all of us. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Other amendments being offered today? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I'd like to offer the A7.
Representative Freiberg offers the A7 amendment to House File 329. Representative Freiberg to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment just kind of emphasizes local control. It says that a local unit of government can require the fire chief or comparable person to approve any permit for retail sales of the three categories of devices we're talking about here. So, you know, we've heard from the Fire Chiefs Association with their concerns about this, so this directly addresses those by allowing local governments to give them the permission to approve permits for these. So I hope members would look favorably on it.
To the bill author on the A7 Amendment, Representative Burick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this, I guess I would like to, or I don't know if our researchers would be able to help me out with it. I believe the way the bill is written and giving, you know, the authority, the local local municipalities would already have this ability through their own permitting process. So I'm not sure that this language would be required.
Yeah, Representative Eric, that was my question, and maybe we will go to Hal's research on this, but if I'm not mistaken, your bill said that counties and cities have the ability to determine whether they're going to allow this or not, and they certainly could set some parameters up within their community on that. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, all the permitting process would also be going through the local municipality, so there's nothing that would tell them that they cannot, and since this is saying they may, not shall, that authority is there for the cities and the municipality.
Representative Piper.
If I read the language, maybe Ms. Dyson could address this, but if I read the language of the bill starting on line 5.26, it says, the local unit of government may not, and then part two is prohibit or restrict the sale or display of sparkling devices, novelties, or aerial and audible devices. To me it says it's basically a preemption provision when it relates to this, so to me it seems like the amendment would make it not be a preemption provision.
Well, let's go to the aforementioned Ms. Dyson and see if she can help us with that. Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill then, as Representative Freiberg mentioned, there is a collection of the local unit of government may not, beginning on 5.26, and it lists a number of things. But then in paragraph D, it says it does not preempt a town or home rule charter city or statutory city from enacting and enforcing ordinances. The author said, I think would be somewhat implied by the regulation authority that the local unit of government could, as part of its regulation, require the fire chief to review and approve.
Representative Fireberg.
I guess to follow up on that, it seems like perhaps the language is a bit in conflict in the bill, and whenever I think there's conflict in a bill, it likely leads to litigation. So, the amendment basically makes it clear because it says notwithstanding the arguably contradictory language in paragraph C, it makes it clear that the local unit of government can require the fire chief to approve any permit for the retail sale. So I think the amendment clarifies some contradictory language within the bill.
Representative Eric.
Mr. Chair, members, if you continue reading where you mention that part where it says they cannot prohibit or restrict the sale or display, it goes on to say in permanent or temporary structures. We're talking about where they can sell them. That's why we put in the tent language to the brick and mortar language with the 60-day separation. So that part is just saying that they cannot restrict that for that part. We are saying that the state part would take precedence.
Representative Freiberg, I just want to see if you have any follow-ups before I go to Representative Nash.
Okay. Well, it seems to me a permanent or temporary structure would include every structure, because every structure is either permanent or temporary. So, I still read the language here as a preemption provision saying the local unit of government cannot prohibit the sale of any of these three categories of devices in any kind of structure, which I think based on what Ms. Dyson said is basically a preemption provision that's in conflict with the language she cited later. So I think the amendment would make it clear.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I remember Representative Freiberg last night was talking about how much he trusts our nonpartisan research staff, and I trust Ms. Dyson's interpretation of this, that the amendment isn't needed, that it does already exist in the bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representatives Rarick and Freiberg, one thing that I would ask you to do is to make sure that the language is the way it is, because I suspect that this bill stop on the general register, this question may come up again. It seems to me, as the chair from the outside looking in, that both of you are trying to accomplish the same thing. Let's just make sure we accomplish the same thing. Representative Freiberg.
I guess just to respond to Representative Nash, we must have heard what she said differently. I kind of detected some assent from her that the language was potentially in conflict. I guess maybe I'll just ask her, not to put her on the spot, but Ms. Dyson, could you say, is the language potentially in conflict here, and would the amendment clarify the conflict?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, I guess I would not want to comment on the implied. What I said was that there is an implication that the regulation in paragraph D that says that this section does not preempt the local governments from enacting and enforcing ordinances that regulate conditions of sale or use, that potentially implied in that is the ability to have a fire chief or official to approve permits as part of that regulation. I think it's also possible that a clarification of the order of what is permitted and what is not permitted might make the bill more clear.
Representative Piper.
So, Representative Nash, what I heard right there was a clarification might make the bill more clear, and I think this amendment provides that clarification.
Ms. Dyson, again, not to put you on the spot, and we'll probably discuss this particular amendment ad nauseum here, but does the amendment provide the clarification that's necessary or more clarification, but still leaving some ambiguity as to whether the outcome?
Mr. Chair, I believe the latter.
Pardon me?
I believe the latter.
The latter. So we can proceed. It does leave some additional ambiguity. We all, I think, are in agreement on the same thing. It is Friday morning. We have been here all week. We have a number of other bills. We can continue to go. I'm here till noon. Remember to, you know, tip your servers and waiters. But I thought that would be funnier than it was. But Representative Nelson, we should just go to your question.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that sometimes comfort language in bills we put in that to try and clarify things. Belts and suspenders is another term we use to make sure it's there. It sometimes gives people comfort. I don't think this amendment harms this bill. I think it just gives some people more clarity. It might, you know, might make it easier to get it passed.
Representative Burke, we are going to give you the final word on the A7 amendment, and then we're going to take it to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I don't believe it's necessary, but I guess I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other, but I don't believe it's necessary at this time.
All those in favor of the A7 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The A7 is not adopted. And I think we'll just defer my previous comments. We all are looking for the same thing. Representative Verrick, please work with the interested stakeholders to try to find language that does resolve the issues that we were talking about. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A4 amendment to the House File 329.
And
Representative
Mr. Chair,
Nelson.
Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment, it's basically we don't want people with the proliferation of drones out there, and we don't want people using drones and using them to be dropping fireworks and firecrackers from the sky. And this kind of comes from a brother-in-law of mine who talks about in his youth that getting him and his friend that lived across the alley from each other used to sit in their second floor windows and they'd shoot bottle rockets back and forth across from each other and have little wars. And so, I mean, this is not that far-fetched. I know that they were and are still are illegal in Minnesota unless this bill passes. But, you know, I just don't want, you know, people come up with ingenious ways to play with fireworks, and it's we hear them all summer long, not just around the 4th of July. At least in my neighborhood, I hear them all summer long, different volumes of them going off. And I just want to make sure that we're safe, that we don't have people come up with new and unique ways of combining the proliferation that we have of drones and fireworks if they become legal.
Representative Burke, to the A4 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I don't
say no.
I don't see that this has really any impact one way or the other. Again, I don't have any feeling one way or the other on this amendment. I think we could go down a path with this, though, where we could start coming up with all kinds of instances that we should be adding into this. But I'll let the committee members decide.
Well, thank you for giving us this with no recommendation from the bill author. Representative Nelson, I do have a question for you on line 1.5. It says drones,
or this is referring to the use of unmanned spacecraft, commonly called aerial drones, or in an area which unmanned aircraft systems may be used. Isn't that the sky in general? I mean, we want to make sure we have clarity, right? That we just had a discussion on that, so I'm just trying to help us out here.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking more around airports. I'm thinking more. I know the DOT is looking at using aerial drones to do inspection of our bridges, things like that. So,
Representative Nelson, I can ask Ms. Dyson. I don't think that what your intention is, what we're looking at here, referring to our previous discussion. Perhaps since the bill author doesn't have a preference one way or the other, we might want to withdraw that and work with him.
Mr. Chair, we could strike the language after the comma, insert a period, and strike the or an unmanned aircraft system, if that makes you more comfortable.
Well, what I'm going to ask Ms. Dyson to do is to review that. We do have another member question, and maybe we'll take that and then come back to that and see what that does for us, if that creates any issues for us. Representative Tyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I'd go on the Google and see what it has to say about drones and fireworks, and actually there's quite a bit of talk about how drones might replace fireworks. So I'm thinking something like this might even be disruptive to some folks who use drones instead of fireworks, which sounds like a little bit safer thing. But I think we saw that possibility during the halftime show at the Super Bowl, where they had drones doing different things in the sky. So I'm a little leery about maybe doing something like that, where we interfere with some great displays that are shown with drones instead of fireworks. Just saying.
Representative Freiberg.
I guess I don't read it that way. It says it just prohibits the use of drones in combination with aerial and audible devices. There's a clear definition of aerial and audible devices on lines 4.18 to 4.21 of the bill in existing law. If drones are able to do something to replace aerial and audible devices, they would not, you know, they would be a drone. They wouldn't meet this definition, is how I read. So I guess I don't see that as an issue at all.
Representative West.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Nelson, on line 1.5, what are aerial drones? Is that that's a font, or is that something that's actually a type of drone?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
That's the way that the federal government describes them, and that's their terminology.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative West, I apologize. It's a typographical error. It should be aerial.
It should be spelled A-R-I-E-L instead of A-R-I-A-L.
Yeah.
This committee is very good at parsing language this morning. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, and to the question from Representative Tice, the halftime show that was done was by professionals, not by the average citizen, and so I think that would not be covered by this amendment or this bill.
Ms. Dyson, I asked if you would look at it and see what that does, if that provides additional clarity or where we're at. Do you have a thought on the matter?
Mr. Chair, if you're referring to striking the language after the comma on line 1.5, the language as it is in the amendment is vague. What I can say is I am aware that there are federal regulations related to the unmanned aircraft systems, the drones, but I don't know what they are. And so I don't know how to make it any – I don't know how to clarify it at this point. But an area in which they may be used, Representative Nelson provided examples in which they may be used, but there may be other areas, and I know that there are pending federal regulations. So I'm not in a position to answer that.
Just for the record, if we do proceed with this, in line 1.4, we have the same typo. Representative Freiberg.
2 points. First of all, I just checked the spelling. The spelling at the beginning of 1.4 is actually correct.
Yes. I just assumed what I said was weird. Yes, you're correct.
I think somebody said A-R-I-E-L before, which would be the name of the character in The Little Mermaid.
We do tend to find ourselves from topic to topic, don't we?
A question for Ms. Dyson, is the amendment divisible after the comma in line 1.5? I know Representative Halverson is really enjoying this conversation.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, I'm not clear what you mean by divisible. The suggestion was to simply strike the language after that. If you want to divide it, then I need to know what part would go with what part so that it either half would read as a whole, but I think you mean just striking it.
And Representative Nelson has already made that offer earlier.
Okay.
Perhaps it's time we just take a position on this, members. Representative Nelson, I will, as the author of this, I will ask you what you want to put forward before the committee for consideration in the A4 amendment.
Mr. Chair, seeing as all the confusion that's going on, I'll pull the A4 amendment for now.
Nicely done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'd like to do the A6 amendment, and this is, I'm serious about this, is if we're going to make these selling fireworks, I want to make sure that they're made in America. Bring jobs back here. I know there's a proliferation of things that are made all over the world, but if we're going to be having to open this up here, I'd like to have create jobs in America for American citizens.
Representative Nelson offers the A6 amendment to the House File 329. Representative Rarick, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I actually really like the amendment. I wish we could take it. Unfortunately, speaking with manufacturers, we would sell nothing in this state if we went with this. So I would ask that you please vote no.
Representative Szczynski, to the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was answered. I just wanted to know if we actually ever manufacture them in the United States.
Seeing no other discussion, Representative Tyler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, every year there's a big convention. The Pyrotechnics Guild International has a big celebration of fireworks. And guess what?
This one?
This year it's in Fargo. You can go. August 5th to the 11th and see all the countries, all the fireworks that are available out there. Actually, I think it's a really good global togetherness project.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
This would be able to start a new industry if they're not already made here now, but with that, I'd like to roll call this amendment.
Other roll call being requested. Any other discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, the clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Bliss?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup?
No.
Lee?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
No.
Samstead?
Yes.
Szczynski?
Yeah.
Heiss?
Yes.
West?
No.
Joachim?
Yes.
Representative Tice wishes to switch her vote. From yes to no. There being eight ayes and nine nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Burke, I think we saved the state of Minnesota what existing fireworks we have based on the fact that there are no manufacturers within the United States or very limited. So those who continue to at least vote for the, by voting no, continue to have fireworks in the state of Minnesota. So I appreciate that. Representative Rarick, member questions on the bill. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to have a roll call on the bill.
Roll call being requested. Member questions. Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Rarick, can you mention for me, I believe the state of Wisconsin allows sale of these fireworks and use of these fireworks today. Is that correct?
Representative Rarick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jessup, yes, they do.
Follow-up question for you then, Representative Varek. Could you tell me what is the situation for the state of Iowa, for the situation for the state of South Dakota, for the situation in North Dakota, please?
Representative Varek. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, the aerial and audible are being sold in North and South Dakota, and I have not checked the status. Iowa was working on expanding theirs the same time we have been.
One last question.
Representative Jessup.
Have the states of Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota been involved in the sale as well as the use of these devices for some time? Do we have some track record that those states are satisfied with their particular operations as they exist today?
Representative Herrera. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jessup, I do not know the dates specifically when they went to those. North and South Dakota have had them for quite some time. Wisconsin, more recently than the two of them, but all three have had it for at least 10 years.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just kind of to follow up, a little comment and then a question to the author. Well, first question to the author. Representative Rarick, on 5.17 to 5.26, you cap the cost that cities can charge for permitting. My concern with that, since we didn't adopt Representative Freiberg's amendment that gave a little bit more clarification about local control, is that if the city so chooses to go down this road, finds that their costs are much more than what the fines can or the fees can cover, they wouldn't have any option to raise those to cover their excess costs of all the inspections and the implementation of this. So is there a reason why you cap that?
Representative Rarick, Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, that was existing language, what was put in when the novelty devices were legalized. We didn't change that. We left it the same.
Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you. And then one quick clarification for Representative Jessup, and this is part of a discussion from a few years ago, so that's the only reason why I know it, why I remember it. I have no clue. Wisconsin does sell fireworks, but anybody can buy them if you're not a resident. If you're a resident, and you have to show your driver's license to buy them. If you're a resident, you're not allowed to buy them unless you've gone to the city where you're going to shoot them off and purchase a permit, and that permit can also be denied. So they control their own citizens more than they control the folks coming across the border to purchase the fireworks. So I'm not sure about Iowa, North Dakota, or South Dakota, but that kind of gives you a little glimpse on the complexity of this issue.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rarick, I know you work hard on this bill every year, so and it's an uphill climb, and I think, frankly, it's an uphill climb for good reason. I've heard from a number of people with regard to the expansion of fireworks, and a lot of people, when they talk about it outside these walls, talk about the fun, I've heard from a lot of people that also talk about the pain that comes with that, particularly people with PTSD, our veterans with PTSD, that the 4th of July and unexpected fireworks in their neighborhoods can be tremendously damaging. People with pets have concerns. And I know that we've heard about the possibility of the increased tax revenue that we could get, but it's very clear from the testimony that we've heard from our local governments and our firefighters that the cost is going to be great for our local governments that are already stretched and our fire departments that are already stretched. I have great concern about the fire department in my community expecting them to pick up the cost is unbelievable, and I don't think that anyone's feeling like their insurance rates are super affordable right now, and yet we are going to, we're looking to pass a law that will, without a doubt, have an increase in our health care costs. And so to put more strain on that system seems irresponsible in the name of fun. And fun with fireworks can be had. I mean, my community, Eagan, is home to one of the best fireworks displays every 4th of July in the state of Minnesota during our Fun Fest. And it is spectacular. And our volunteer firefighters are out there helping control the situation and make sure that our community is safe and looking at things like weather, wind, making sure that any potential for fire is mitigated and our local Lions are out there working with the fire department to make our community celebration really special, but make it safe and make it expectable for the people who might struggle when they have unexpected explosions in their neighborhood. So I, as you know, don't support your bill for very practical reasons. I support a lot of fun, but I really have concerns about both costs to our communities, our insurance rates, and cost in terms of injury. So, thanks.
Other member questions, other member comments at this time? Questions? Representative Burke, we will give you the final word before we take the roll call on House File 329.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time that you've given me for the bill. What I would like to address just briefly, if you go drive around on the 4th of July or in the weekend near it, you'll see that the aerial and audible fireworks are here. So will there be an increase in usage if we pass this bill? I would say yes, but I do not believe it is going to be dramatic. The majority of the people who want to use them are getting them. So are we going to see a dramatic increase in injuries and fires and costs? I do not believe so. What we will have is neighbors who are willing to talk to their neighbors and say, I'm going to be doing this on the 4th of July because it's not an illegal activity anymore. And if we look at it, I took this bill up when Representative Kreisel was no longer here, an Iraq war veteran. One of the members carrying it as the main author in Iowa is also an Iraq war veteran. So one of the statements Representative Kreisel had made in an earlier testimony was just, being made aware and being able to talk about it. So I do understand those concerns. I really do. But I believe the majority of Minnesotans get it. We can be injured and hurt in all kinds of activities. Concussions are a dramatic issue when our youth sports. We're not trying to outlaw youth sports. We're trying to educate people on how to better do that. Well, I believe we should take the same approach with fireworks. Education is better than banning. Thank you.
I renew my motion that House File 329 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Aye.
Bliss?
Yes.
Freiberg?
No.
Halverson?
No.
Jessup?
Yes.
Lee?
No.
Nathan?
No.
Nash?
Yep.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Quam?
Pass.
Sandsted?
No.
Swedzinski?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Joachim?
No.
Quam?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 10 nays, you'll understand my next comment after this. There being 9 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does prevail. House File 329 will be going to the General Register. And with that, folks, we're going to take about a 10-minute recess to get a chance to get up and stretch, and we'll be back 10:45 for the call of the chair. We are standing recess.
I don't have one. I just have to turn my hair off.
So I guess there's some stuff going on.
I did four of those in corners. So.
Oh.
And the one taking
an
oval box.
I'm not sure.
Okay. I've heard the term.
Her man, her language is different than his diary. They're going to go to conference. It gives them the opportunity. If we vote truly down, it would make it more difficult for Sarah to do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, we can take those.
And we already have the power for it, like we'll be taking.
That's what's going on there.
Thank you.
Well, we're waiting for some folks to get back on our side.
Oh, I was referencing
the before they take them.
That's a fun bill.
I'll vote for it.
Dan.
Yep.
I'm going to just try to blaze right through this.
We'll call the committee back to order. And the next bill on the agenda is going to be House File 1896. Representative Nash, if you'd like to move your bill before the committee and to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1896. Members, you've heard me talk a lot about cybersecurity. If you've been unfortunate enough to be stuck with me in other committees, and you know that I love IT. Members, cybersecurity is a big deal. And in order for the legislature to appropriately interact with MNIT on the issue of cybersecurity, MNIT expressed concerns that they don't have a group of people who they can consistently interact with. This bill, Mr. Chair and members, creates a legislative commission on cybersecurity, so members who will be appointed, three from the House, three from the Senate, that will be able to work on cybersecurity with MNIT. And Mr. Chair, if you would, I'd like to do a quick oral amendment. This was drafted by the Senate, and there are times that I think the Senate must forget that the House exists. Maybe you've heard that somewhere, but on lines 2.22 through 2.26, they talk about the the 2.25, it says from among the Senate members, they must select a chair. I'd really like to think that maybe there's a couple of House members that could be elected chair of this commission. So if Mr. Gehring, you could walk us through how we could change that so it could just be elected from the members that are appointed, and because we all don't want to necessarily bow and genuflect to senators only, and have the chance of a House chair being elected to this. Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, so the oral amendment would then be on line 2.25, you delete Senate. So you'd say the commission must select a chair from among the members at the first meeting?
Mr. Chair, that is my desired amendment.
Mr. Gehring, if you could once again cite the oral amendment.
So, Mr. Chair, the proposed oral amendment is on 2.25, delete the word Senate.
I'd like to hear you say the word delete Senate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, we could insert House in place of Senate.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to create a level playing field for whoever might be elected chair, but if Representative Nelson would like to do that, hey, you know.
I could try to create a kumbaya moment by removing Senate here.
But Mr. Chair, by doing that, it's going to have to go to conference. If they have House in there, then they can argue about that. You're going to have to go there anyway. Straighten that out there between the two of you.
My hope is that Representative Nash will prevail on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I just have one question. If I'm looking at 2.4, it says the officer shall alternate between a member of the Senate and a member of the House.
Representative Mason, we're to the deletion here to get the. I thought I heard you referring to 2.4. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, so the proposed amendment is on 2.25, you know, to delete Senate. And so what's happening in the Section 2 of the bill is it's setting procedures for convening the first meeting and choosing the first chair of the commission, and you're correct. So in Section 1 of the bill on 2.4, this is the process once the commission is established for rotating the chair back and forth between the Senate and the House. And so what Representative Nash has amended here is just clarifying who kicks the commission off.
Representative Mason, does that help? My apologies. All right. Any other discussion? Mr. Gehring, would we want to take a is that an amendment, or is that going to be an incorporation, do you think, on the language change?
Friendly amendment.
Deleting the Senate.
No problem.
Mr. Chair, so that's a proposed oral amendment because you don't have an amendment in front of you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Geary.
It's an oral amendment. To be
all right. All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Representative Nash, the bill is now in the order in which you would like it. We'll ask you to proceed with your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I gave it a very quick description. I've got with me Commissioner Chris Boozy, who is the Chief Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. It works at Minute, and I would like to ask him to testify on this bill.
Commissioner, welcome to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Christopher Boozy. I'm an Assistant Commissioner for Minute Services and also the state's Chief Information Security Officer. I would like to start off by saying we've had an opportunity to testify before a number of different legislative commissions, legislative committees, both in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And we've talked about some of the cybersecurity challenges that we face as a government. The risks that we're facing on a daily basis are very severe. We have issues with a technology footprint that's difficult to manage. We also have issues with a cybersecurity program where we need some more resources. But one of the things that's very clear is that if we're going to be successful going forward, we're going to have a better partnership between the legislative and the executive branches of government. We have to have a transparent forum. We can really sit down with members and talk about some of the issues that we face so that we don't have to come to committee hearings and talk to policymakers and talk about tools and big money asks where people haven't had a chance to understand the details in the trenches. So from the perspective of Minnesota IT Services, I think this is a wonderful step forward, and it's something that will help our government be more successful in this space. So we wholeheartedly support the bill.
Commissioner, thank you for your testimony. Members, question for the commissioner or the bill author? Seeing none. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to thank Representative Nash for his leadership in this area, for having brought all of your expertise from the private sector to state government, and the result of what you're doing here is going to benefit the state of Minnesota in an impactful way. So thank you so much.
Members, questions for the commissioner or the bill author? Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee on House File 1896? Sir, come on forward, if you will. We'll ask you to state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Again, please just state your name and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association, and I'd just like to go on record saying that the Minnesota High Tech Association also supports this legislation.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? If not, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, members, appreciate your support.
Representative Nash renews his motion that House File 1896 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Vogel, you're going to be hitting a triple here this morning. We'll give you the next three bills. Oh! And look at that. Look at that.
All right, I'll do it.
Representative Vogel, what I think we'll do is we'll start with House File 1146, and I will move that before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Vogel, welcome and thanks for being with us today. House File 1146 is before the committee. Proceed with your testimony and presentation of your bill.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I brought some treats, figuring by this time of the day that a little sugar and carbs might be a good idea. As well as offloading my responsibility, I was a little concerned this morning that Chair Davids might be in, and he's got kind of a sixth sense for Quick Trip donuts. So you won, and he didn't get here this morning.
Well, Representative Vogel, we don't want to say that too loud because Representative Chair Davids may find his way down.
So, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing House File 1146. Refer to it as the franchise fee transparency bill, and
What happened here was a few years ago, I heard of a local city that was looking at building their community center and using the franchise fee as a financing method to make the payments on them. So it caught my attention, and I started investigating what are franchise fees doing. And after I started researching, found out that they're quite common. I went back and I found out that the statute kind of started off with a somewhat of an intent of that that the franchisees would be using like the right of way or whatever, and there'd be some cost to recoup. But then I found out that it's really general in nature and can be used for really an alternative revenue source to supplement the tax base, basically. Very limited in its public notification rules and statute. And the utilities generally are not in a position to disagree with them because they're wanting to use the right-of-way and they're somewhat concerned if they make too much of a fuss that might not happen. And I suspect in general most people aren't even aware that they have franchise fees on your utility bills. So I came to the conclusion that I could basically approach this from two points. The first would be to put restrictions on what these fees could be used for and try to get them back to just basically what kind of a cost are they imposing on the city for right-of-way. But came to the conclusion that two things happen here. First of all, that's really hard to define in statute. And secondly, I didn't want to infringe on the public's right, if they want to tax themselves in this manner, to make that decision, but to make it fully informed. So came up with the transparency approach, which this bill does, which basically allows the citizens to be more fully informed of what they are. It allows them to decide on how much and what methods that these franchise fees could be used for, and then puts in place a process so that the municipalities, most times municipalities that's going to be instituting them, follows this so that hopefully there's true transparency as well as accountability, since these fees will never be reviewed at a truth and taxation meeting like the property tax would. So that's the basic outline on how 1146 got here. I do have an author's amendment, and the reason for the author's amendment is I have talked at length with the League of Minnesota Cities, recognizing that this would impose some more burden on the way franchise fees are dealt with. And as I said, my intent was not necessarily to stop them dead in their tracks, although that might have been what I would like to have done, but came to the conclusion that let's add transparency and let the citizens truly decide whether or not this is a good idea. So if you... Mr. Chair would be willing to move the A1. I can explain what that would do.
Representative Vogel, I will move the A1 amendment and to get the bill in the shape that you would like. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Maybe you want to tell us a little bit, Representative Vogel, what the A1 amendment does.
Initially, the bill put in place, the city would have to have a forward referendum. So they would notify the ratepayers of what was going to happen, how much it was going to cost, and what they were going to do with money. And then it would have to appear on the ballot at the next general election. After long conversations, I came to the conclusion that that might impose too much of a burden on a city or a city council for what might be a desired use by the taxpayer. So what the amendment does is it inserts language that if more than 5% of the registered voters by petition, after being fully informed, decide that they want to put it on the ballot, it would then appear on the next general election ballot.
Representative Vogel, thank you. Questions to the A1 amendment? Representative Freiberg.
I apologize. It just took a bite of a carrot.
Not a donut, but a carrot. Good for you.
I have both a donut and a carrot.
Oh. Says equalizing.
Just two of the four food groups. What would happen to cities with existing franchise fees?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's in the main part of the bill that does not change. And they would be able to keep the franchise fees as are now in place up until 2022. And at that point, they would have to go through the same process as those cities looking to institute a new franchise fee.
Representative Freiberg. Other member questions on the A1 to get the bill in the shape the author wishes? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion and amendment, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted to House File 1146, excuse me. Representative Vogel, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I pretty much explained it. I do have a testifier from the Northwest Chamber that would like to speak to you about the impacts that she has seen in that area.
Representative Vogel, let's bring your testifier in. And again, members, we'll take other public testimony. If there's anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the Commission, House File 1146, we'll ask you to get in queue here.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, one more thing, please. Yes, if I could have the page distribute a... article that I found that might be helpful.
Excellent. James is to your left right there, Representative Volga. He'll take care of it for us.
Thank you.
With that, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, who you represent. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Lori Higgins. I'm the president of the Metro North Chamber of Commerce, which represents over 725 businesses in the North Metro and Anoka County area. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Be the voice of business is something that we take very seriously, and so to have a few moments to tell you about our opposition to franchise fees in relation to this legislation before you today is something I truly appreciate. First and foremost, franchise fees are not a transparent cost of government. Currently, franchise fees are required to be collected by the respective utility company, not the specific unit of government that is actually mandating and using the fee revenues. Taxpayers are oftentimes in the dark as to who is actually imposing this fee, oftentimes assuming it is the utility since it's on their utility invoice, but in actuality, the utility in turn must reimburse the city. Further, there is little transparency as to for what purpose this franchise fee is being used. While a city may begin the process of establishing franchise fees over the need to fix a road or some other project, oftentimes the collected monies easily become an expected part of a revenue stream in perpetuity. In fact, to further emphasize that point, a business owner once told me that in a discussion with a city official, it was remarked that the city would have to cut staff if the franchise fee were eliminated. That is ironic, considering that that one business alone is paying the city over $40,000 a year in franchise fees, which the business itself could have used to hire another employee or to further grow their business and contribute to the local economy. Finally, on the issue of transparency, there is very rarely widely shared information for residents and businesses when the franchise fee issue is under consideration by municipalities. Requiring legislation mandating greater communication by the municipality to allow taxpayers a better chance to provide feedback much earlier in the process is not only common sense, but it also benefits the greater good for the valuable relationship between the city and its stakeholders. Additionally, providing the opportunity for a citizen-led referendum on establishing a new fee also fits an inherent part of the democratic process. Besides the critical concern of governmental transparency, these franchise fees negatively impact job growth and business expansion, especially among high-energy users, specifically large commercial and industrial companies. These businesses pay solid wages and benefits in the communities where they reside and are often the very engine of the American economy. Without growth and expansion, this in turn hurts the city from economic development consideration. As an example, one North Metro city charges 4% of their utility bill for the franchise fee. This 4% collectively aggregates into a substantial amount. One employer pays over $76,000 a year to the city just in that franchise fee alone, and that is revenue off of their bottom line that they must find ways to offset, either through more sales or less expenses, and that can actually affect their decisions to expand. Another example is the increase of the franchise fee in Duluth last fall. Their local paper mill, which employs over 250 people, would have seen their franchise fee go from $270,000 a year to $810,000 a year if the city had increased their fee from 1% to 3%. In the end, the city put a cap on the fee for the paper mill to $420,000 a year, recognizing the hardship it would have created for them. So the legislation by Representative Vogel is a good step to require greater openness by city officials considering a franchise fee, and I respectfully urge your consideration thereof. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions for the testifier? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either to the testifier or to Representative Vogel. With regard to expansion, do franchise fees expand if businesses expand?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, franchise fees are charged in one of two ways generally. One is by meter. The other is by usage. So the answer would be, I would say yes, if indeed it's by usage, because that's what's happening with some of these companies. I mean, that article that I just passed around, you can see the impact that this can have. So I would say that it certainly could, and I'm not sure, maybe Ms. Higgins would have some observations on whether or not she's ever talked to a business or had businesses talk to her about expansion plans and how that might impede their decision to want to if there's one available in that city.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, actually just yesterday I was speaking with a North Metro business who was looking to add 60,000 square feet to his property, and he already pays over $5,000 a month in franchise fees, and so it is a factor as to whether or not he would like to expand, which would in turn he would hire, you know, additional folks as well. So it's a major consideration. Thank you.
Representative Halverson, follow-up. Other member questions for the testifier? We do have two testifiers that have signed up. I will bring them both down so we can keep them in queue. We have Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities and Scott Neal, the city manager. We'll start with Mr. Carlson, followed by Mr. Neal. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. I ask you to state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to testify with the concerns on the original bill and a few remaining concerns with the modifications. I do want to thank the author for putting up with me in his office for many hours talking about this bill. He does have a nice, comfortable couch, though, so it was an easy conversation. Mr. Chair, the bill as introduced was very problematic, and I think Representative Vogel has kind of outlined some of those concerns. The two-year renewal would have been very problematic for cities trying to plan for the revenue stream into the future, not to mention that it would have required a referendum, a forward referendum, I think, as you described, each 2 years to basically renew that franchise fee. The amendment does address some of our most serious concerns with the bill. By allowing a five-year referendum to occur and instituting a reverse referendum, it doesn't mean that an election would be held every 2 years. It would give the voters some outlet if they really were dissatisfied. But we'd like to continue to work with the author on the bill. I haven't fully vetted this with all of our cities across the state. There are roughly 350 cities, I think, that have some sort of an electric or gas franchise fee in place. And between now and the time this is discussed on the floor, I would like to get back to Representative Vogel with any other observations cities may have about issues that remain with the language. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Scott Neal, the city manager in Edina. The law that governs franchise fees, 216B, does not have a lot of prescriptive things for cities to follow when they're imposing these. But let me assure you that our cities across the state take these very seriously and have tried many things to inform their electorate about why they're imposing the fees, discussing how the monies would be used, and Mr. Neal can give a good example of how Edina has done that.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Neal, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Neal. I'm the city manager in Edina, Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Vogel for his, again, for his patience and for his cooperation in hearing some of our concerns and addressing them in the amendment today. I think I'd like to first start out by talking just a little bit about what franchise fees, utility franchise fees, are. They are collected by 300-plus cities in the state. They're used for a variety of activities and functions in city government. And I have a few examples for you today. Hopkins collects about $600,000 in utility franchise fees last year. They use about half of that money for general fund property tax relief. The other half is used for park improvements, so their park improvement fund. In Eden Prairie, they collect about $2 million a year, and they use that money for street maintenance functions. So instead of special assessing their residents and taxpayers for street assessments, they use their utility franchise fees to cover that. In Sartell collects about $268,000 a year, and they use it for street maintenance fees as well. In Edina, we collect around $1.3 million a year, and we divide ours between sidewalks and pedestrian cyclist safety, those kind of expenses, and sustainability. It's about a three-to-one split between sustainability and conservation utility charges or improvements for our systems. Our city began imposing utility franchise fees in 2013. There's really a long process to be able to impose these fees in terms of doing it by ordinance, but there's also some franchise agreements with utility companies that allow for 60 and sometimes 90-day notices between when they're first notified and when they are told that the franchise can actually go forward. So there's a notice period. We issued a notice to our residents both in our newspaper, in our newsletters, and also through a ratepayer stuffer in utility bills. We held a public hearing at which I believe we had one person testify, expressing some concerns but expressing some supports, because our council dedicated made a fairly clear statement about what we were going to spend the money on, and that was important to our residents and our ratepayers. Two key pieces that I think are important in how we've handled franchise fees. First is we segregate the revenues in our budget. So they're held in a special revenue fund so we can account for them. We account for every dollar that we collect through franchise fees and how we spend that. And many cities do that as well. We also our council also required that city staff do an annual report to the council on how much money was collected in the previous year, how it was spent. We do that report both in a written form and also in a verbal. That's put out to our residents on live cable TV. It's archived on our website, and there's also, as I said, a written report that they can get as well. For our council, one of the things they liked about the franchise fee is that it is transparent, that people can see it. It is a line item on your utility bill, and it's no less transparent than the state's retail sales tax. You know, that retail sales tax is charged at the point of purchase. It's written on a bill. You can see it. You may not know what it's going to be spent on, but you know that you're paying it, and you know that that's getting passed on to state government. Utility franchise fee is very similar to that. Our council also thought that the tax impact or the tax incidence was favorable as well. That one of the gold standards in any kind of tax description is a broad base and a low rate. By including everyone in the utility franchise fee payment scheme that is able to that benefits from whatever we're trying to do in sidewalks or street maintenance, everyone pays. So whether they're a profit, nonprofit, some of our large nonprofits in our community, Fairview Southdale Hospital, for example, they benefit quite a bit from the street work and the public safety functions that we do. And they have a chance. This is their opportunity to make a small contribution to that, as opposed to some cities that do use a percentage-based franchise fee. We use a flat franchise fee in Edina. So a resident pays $1.95 per meter per month per utility. The largest fee is $40.50. So that big gas meter that fuels Fairview Southdale Hospital or Southdale Mall have that same lever.
You've been testifying for about 5 minutes at this point, and I just want to – we get the gist of
gotcha.
That. But if you can just help us to wrap up, we greatly appreciate
that. We think that our use of these funds have been accountable for our council, and from city council members are accountable back to residents, and they're happy to answer questions about how we spend that money, and we're happy to tell you about how we do it too.
Mr. Neal, thank you for showing us the different ways that the city of Edina and other communities across the state may utilize the franchise. We have a question from Representative Peterson. Other member questions as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, maybe you can answer this for me. I was just curious, you know, you mentioned electric and gas as some of the utilities. What are some other things that cities use franchise fees for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, there are cable franchise fees as well. Those aren't governed by this statute. This is 216B, so those are in another section of state statute. So this section deals with just gas and electric.
Representative Peterson, follow-up? Well,
then I guess maybe the question is to the author. I mean, should those other types of franchise fees be also in this type of a bill?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I did explore that, but there, when you get into some of those fees, they also have some federal guidelines relative to that. So, and this seemed to be, as you saw from that Duluth article, where we really needed to address the issue, because I think this is really where the big money is and where the big transparency needs to be. But thank you for the thought, because we have to look at a lot of different fees, maybe as taxes.
Other member questions at this time? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. Oh, Representative, excuse me, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you for the promotion, Mr. Chair. I forgot to mention that I was also expressing the thoughts of the Metro Cities organization. They asked me to streamline the testimony, so I want to make sure on the record that Metro Cities has the same positions that the League does.
Mr. Carlson, thank you for that addition. At this time, is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on the matter before the Committee on House File 1146? Any other public testimony? Seeing none, hearing none, other member questions? Representative Vogel, we will give you the final word.
Thank you. I'll make it quick. I could have brought lots of examples. You can see what these fees are, how large they are, what they're being used for. My feeling is that we need a standardized process because not everybody has done probably as good a job as Edina in the way they've approached this. That's what this bill does. It is not an attack on local government, and it is not usurping any of their power. Basically, it is bringing transparency to what I feel is a tax rather than a fee. I also think that buried below this to some extent, if indeed it is considered a tax rather than a fee, that the way it is extended to exempt properties, there may be some issues with that. So hopefully by having a more transparent process, it may set the cities up better to be able to comply with all of those laws. So finally, I would just ask for your support, because what I think we all are interested in doing is bringing transparency to government, and that's what this does, without infringing on their right to serve their citizens, if that's what their citizens want. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vogel, before I gave you the last word, I missed one member. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember the welcome to being a city council and mayor class I had. Our city administrator at the city of Waconia, who is on a decidedly different side of the aisle than I am, was explaining franchise fees, and she said, you know, we don't want to do those because they're a tax, and they're ultimately going to hurt businesses, and they're going to increase the cost to the resident. And, you know, the information on this, what the imposition would be to the city of Duluth, in Duluth to the paper mill, was shocking, and it seems to really kind of quell business growth, because we've been talking about when businesses do better in Duluth. I think we heard when we all do better, we all do better, and this doesn't help the city of Duluth. And so for that reason, Mr. Chair, I'd like to roll call this vote.
Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll.
Oh, I'm sorry. I renew my motion that House File 1146 be referred to the General Register as amended. Now we'll take the roll call.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Aye.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton? Freiberg?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup? Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Yes.
Samstead?
Yes.
Swedzinski?
Yeah.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
You, Joaquim?
Yes.
There being 15 ayes and 0 nays, the bill will be re-referred to, the motion passes, the bill will be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Vogel, you have another bill that we will be bringing forward. Let's do House File 1936. I will move House File 1936 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Vogel, you will proceed with our bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, we'll have two of these, and I've been requested to offer them, and I'd like to actually turn the description over, if I could, please, to the testifier, who is more familiar with a lot of the detail, because they tend to be kind of technical in nature.
Representative Vogel, we will do just that. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name, who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Farrell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Accounting Services Division of Minnesota Management and Budget. House File 1936 is a technical housekeeping bill related to accounting operations. It looks very large. However, 75 of the 80 sections of this bill update language regarding state payments to make it more reflective of current modern business practices. Most of our state statutes were created at a time when the only way to issue a payment was by a state warrant. A warrant is a paper document that functions somewhat similar to a check. One of the key differences is that checks are cleared by a bank, and our warrants are cleared or redeemed through the state treasury. In today's electronic age, most of the state's payments are issued by electronic funds transfer. During fiscal year 2016, over 90% of the state's payments were issued electronically instead of by paper warrant. This proposal will update statutory references to acknowledge other forms, other electronic forms of payment by changing the word warrant to payment. In addition, there are five sections of this bill that address other topics, and I'll run through these for you quickly. Section 4 is a statute that authorizes the state to make payments in advance for certain types of goods and services. The proposed change here will allow other types of prepayments when advance payment discounts are provided or for other costs that are customarily paid for in advance. Section 9 updates a reference to a statute that was previously renumbered. Minnesota Statute 7.19 was renumbered to 16A.271. Section 13 clarifies that the state is not liable to redeem a warrant that has been determined to have been invalid and void. The purpose of this is really to prevent unnecessary disputes and litigation. We have on occasion been taken to conciliation court by third-party check cashing companies for not redeeming a canceled warrant that has been presented to us. We have been successful in defending against those claims in court. However, we feel that having a more specific provision in statute may head off some of these claims in the future. There is similar language in law under Minnesota Statute 16A.46. However, that statute relates to lost or destroyed warrants and does not specifically address the situation where a warrant is simply void without reissuing a duplicate. Section 17 and 18 clarify the roles and responsibilities of MMB and other state agencies for accounting and collecting debts owed to the state. Everything else in the bill is changing the word warrant to payment, as previously described. There is no fiscal impact to this bill, and I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Farrell, for your testimony. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that comes forward frequently to us and to the House. But the only question I have is, 2 years ago we had the un-session. Why wasn't this brought forward then as part of the un-session when we went through, and we did a whole lot of these, where we went through and cleaned up language, eliminated stuff, and so I'm curious why this didn't come forward at that time.
Let's see if we can find the answer. Ms. Farrell.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, actually the work on this bill was started as part of the un-session, and at that time we did not finish in time to make a committee deadline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We don't know how important committee deadlines are. Other questions for the bill author or for the testifier from members? Anyone else in the public or anyone here today wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1936. Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Vogel, I don't see any other member questions. We'll give you the final word.
I'd ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Vogel, I will renew my motion that House File 1936 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. The final bill, Representative Vogel, that you have before the committee today is House File 1926. I will move that before the committee to be re-referred to the, again, Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, as a member of the State Government Finance Committee, this is the Department of Administration Agency bill, and I'm introducing it, and I'm going to have them, if you will allow, do the explanation on it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, Mr. Chair, for the record, and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for record, my name is Matt Shear. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Administration. First, I wanted to thank Representative Vogel for carrying the proposal for us this year. This is the admin policy bill, and there's five distinct sections. I'll walk through them one by one. Section one of the bill, admin, has a program called STAR, which is within relation to assistive technology. It's a federally funded program. The program is required by federal law to have a council, and on that council there sit both public members and members who are state employees. The state employee members, it's actually part of their job description, so what this change does is it allows the other commissioners to tell the commissioner of administration who to appoint, as opposed to having those folks go through the governor's appointments process. Simply simplifies things for those members who are state employees, and that's part of their job description. Section 2 of the bill is related to intellectual property and state contracts. Currently, admin reviews all contracts that the state signs, and in particular with relation to intellectual property, this statute requires that the Attorney General sign off on that. In practice, admin has been the one to make sure that the intellectual property mandate is followed, and then the Attorney General is just signing off to comply with statute. This proposal shifts that burden to the Department of Admin, and we've checked with the Attorney General's office, and she is not opposed to this change. Section 3 of the bill is about the Office of Equity and Procurement. For those of you who might sit on state government finance, you might recall that last session there was a change item that was funded giving the Department of Administration additional resources to improve state contracting outcome with businesses that are owned by women, veteran, and minority-owned business. This section just codifies those responsibilities into statute. Our reason for adding this in particular is that when we receive the funds after that time we created the Office of Equity and Procurement, we just want to make sure that that's clear in statute. Section 4 of the bill makes a small tweak to language about those preference programs that the Office of Equity and Procurement actually covers. We were approached by some businesses from the private sector who were interested in streamlining the way it would be that those businesses become certified under the state program. Those businesses are required to meet three criteria. First, that they're 51% owned by a woman, a veteran, or a minority-owned individual, that they meet certain size standards that the federal government sets forth, and that they're from the state of Minnesota. This proposal allows the Commissioner of Administration to accept a certification from another business entity or an outside group that has already certified that business is 51% owned by women, veteran, or minority-owned businesses, and then the admin would still have to verify the size standards and that they're from Minnesota. And finally, Mr. Chair, Section 5 of the bill is in respect to the Data Analytics Master Contract. That's a program that came into existence in 2012. Admin currently administers this program, and we've had it for about 5 years. We currently offer 12 different categories, and of those 12 categories, three have never been used, and four of the others that have been used two or less times. So in getting some feedback from other state agencies, the purpose of this provision is to actually expand that program to allow us to meet the demands of state agencies and what they're actually asking us to cover under a master contract program.
Mr. Shear, thank you for your testimony. Members, questions for Mr. Shear on House File 1926? Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1926. Seeing no one, no member questions, Representative Vogel will give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to be in front of the committee and present the bill.
I will renew my motion that House File 1926 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Okay. The next bill that we'll have on the agenda today, Representative Pugh, House File 1285. And members, what we are going to be doing with House File 1285, this is, if you remember earlier in the not-so-distant past, we took up some different bills relating to rulemaking, and we did not get to this bill since we're kind of doing some cleanup stuff today. We thought we'd take this bill. This will also be laid over as the other bills were as well for future discussion as it relates to rulemaking. So Representative Pugh, welcome to the committee.
ask you to go ahead and get settled in, and then we'll have you go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to present my rulemaking bill, House File 1285, to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. I also, if I could ask a page, I also have treats. I have Girl Scout cookies that I purchased from my darling little neighbor, and we'll start one set right here. Thank you. And for Representative Nash, who's not here, Representative Nash doesn't do sugar.
Representative Pugh, I don't mean to interrupt, but you just mentioned his name and he appears.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure that he'll be delighted with this little clementine, since he can't have sugar, doesn't do sugar. And Mr. Chairman, I have an author's amendment that I had drafted since we were last in committee on Thursday that I would like to...
If you'd like to move the A1 amendment, now's a great time to do that, Representative Pugh.
Yes. I would actually like to move the A1 amendment and ask that Mr. Gehring share with the committee the specifics of this, and then I'll speak to why I felt this was necessary.
Representative Pugh, just kind of an order of operations, do you want to explain what the bill is, and then we'll talk about what the changes might be in the amendment? It might be a little bit easier than talking about what the changes are before you talk about what's in the bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what my bill does is call for legislative oversight of the rulemaking process. So before an agency could promulgate rules, the rules would need to come back before the legislature to be approved by the Government Operations Committee.
And now to the A1 amendment, Mr. Gehring.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, so the A1 amendment adds two new sections to the bill. As Representative Pugh described, what her bill, the underlying bill is doing is requiring legislative approval of the rules before they can take effect. And there are two sections in the rulemaking process that allow a faster rulemaking proceeding to happen in exchange effectively for a shorter duration of the rules. This process exists for the exempt rulemaking process and also for the good cause rulemaking process. So when these two types of rules are adopted, the current law provides that the rules are only effective for 2 years. And what the amendment A1 does is change that two-year duration period to instead having these rules be effective until the legislature adjourns the annual legislative session that began after the date of publication. So what this would do effectively is shorten the two-year window to a period that might be as short as 3 or 4 months or could be as long as about a year and 3 or 4 months, depending on the timing of the legislative session. And it gives the legislature the opportunity to come back and approve these good cause exempt rules or the regular exempt rules following the policy that Representative Pugh is proposing in her bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And if I could just ask for a point of clarification. So my understanding is that should there be a threat or a serious situation during the interim, that an agency would be required or would really need to promulgate rules, that in fact they would be able to do so and those rules would go into effect during the interim. Is that correct?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, yes, that's correct. So on page 2 of your amendment, this is the good cause rulemaking process, and you see on line 2.25 the existing statute that allows for agencies to adopt rules that address a serious and immediate threat to public health, safety, or welfare. And then what you see on page 3, the new language provides that these types of rules would be effective through the end of the legislative session that begins after the adoption of the rule.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Gehring, and thank you for that clarification. And members, when we heard, when we were in committee on Thursday, and I believe it was, we heard two other rulemaking bills, one by our colleague Representative Kresha and another by Representative Green. It struck me, knowing the bill that I had drafted, that should a situation occur that I just mentioned, that being a threat, you know, that would occur, that I needed to do an author's amendment to ensure that an agency had the wherewithal and our approval via statute to actually act on that. But that I wanted for the for us to be able to come back, the legislature, to actually approve of that amendment. So that was the purpose for what I did. So I would like to add that amendment to my bill.
Representative Pugh, the amendment is before the committee. Members' questions on the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, is the I didn't hear, where is this bill going from?
Laid over, okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Representative Pugh, to the bill as amended.
Hey, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I think I'll start just by saying that before I came to the legislature in 2013 was the first year that I served, I had no idea what rulemaking was. You know, we all hear about rules and regulations, but having had the opportunity to serve on government operations for actually the last three bienniums, I learned what rulemaking was, and it was really an eye-opener to me. For members of the public, I think they probably don't understand, but it's important to understand that rules have the full force and effect of law. And what I learned was that there are, I believe, at least 100 agencies that have rulemaking authority. And in fact, right now in the legislature, there are 45 active rulemaking procedures going on right now in various types of rulemaking. So I really felt because the rules have the full force and effect of law that it was imperative that there be increased legislative oversight. What I learned when I delved into this issue in 2013 from colleagues that had a lot more institutional knowledge and experience than I, in fact, I remember having this discussion with Representative Nelson. The legislature used to have, via subcommittees, just much more legislative oversight, and I think that that would be a very good idea, and that's why I did this. I see that, in fact, one other thing I'll mention is that there is a whole section of our statutes that is dedicated to rulemaking, Chapter 14. It was a surprise to me to meet with Mark Shepard, who was our Mr. Gehring of the past, and I met with Mark upstairs to discuss some rulemaking provisions that I wanted to put forth in the last biennium. And just as we can see the volumes of statutes that are sitting in the cubby behind our chair, and we can see session law books, there's that same amount of volume of books of rules and rulemaking upstairs. And that was just a real eye-opener to me as well. So I know I do have at least one testifier here, and I also we have an administrative law judge here who could answer any questions if the chair would like.
Let's take your testifier first because there are some others from the agencies that would like to weigh in. So let's take your testifier first. Or is your testifier from the agency?
No. My testifier is here actually if there are any questions. So okay, maybe we'll just wait for our administrative law judge, Pusey.
Very good. So a resource, not a testifier today is what I'm hearing.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, with that, we will bring forward Elizabeth Carlson from the Department of Natural Resources. And if Ms. Fiona Ruth then would like to also join at this time, we'll hear from both of you. Good morning and welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record and who you represent and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Elizabeth Carlson. My title, that's spelled C-A-R-L-S-O-N. My title is Strategic Planning and Policy Administrator at the Department of Natural Resources. I am offering comments and concerns on HF 1285 for as introduced on behalf of the DNR, the Department of Health, at Department of Agriculture, and other state agencies. And I am joined by our staff attorney, Fiona Riven, who will follow me with a few additional comments. My comments will focus on process comments. The Section 1 and 2 of the bill focus on rules that are adopted with or without a hearing for the full rulemaking process under Chapter 14. If the legislature does approve a rule under this process, the changes that are proposed here could postpone the effective date of some rules as long as 12 to 18 months. And our concern is that this could actually double the time of the full rulemaking process and degrade the timeliness and responsiveness of agency rulemaking. It would be confusing for the public because it will be hard to determine when rules would actually become effective. And the agency would be obligated to notify the regulated parties about delay and continuing uncertainty. It adds another lengthy step to an already long process and disregards the public's contributions in shaping the rules in the first place. The opposite of our shared goal of making government more responsive and efficient and streamlined. We feel that local governments and business and participating citizens deserve more certainty for planning their own decisions and lives, and we feel that these changes to Chapter 14 would not necessarily accomplish that. We have an example for you. Delaying rules by waiting for legislative approval after the fact, after publishing the notice of adoption, would have the potential of creating some necessary unnecessary hardship and uncertainty for Minnesota's industries. For example, the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Agriculture jointly administer Minnesota's Food Code, Chapter 4626. Those agencies are currently revising the entire code for the first time since 1999. This revision has been underway for several years and is approaching completion now. Food establishments, grocery stores, the hospitality industry have all been heavily involved in shaping our outdated rules to meet their current needs as well as the agency's need to better protect public health, and they are all eager for this process to be completed. Requiring legislative approval as an additional stop at the end of this process would make implementation of this and similar state laws and policies very cumbersome, and it would also delay the removal of outdated, obsolete, or unnecessary rules along the way. And then Section 2, along with that, amends Minnesota Statute Section 14.27 about when rules become effective if adopted without a public hearing. That matches the change in Section 1, which deals with rules adopted with a hearing. Going on, I want to also add some comments about Section 3, which amends the statute for expedited permanent rulemaking procedure. And this is a similar change that would require that a rule adopted using this expedited permanent rulemaking procedure that could only be effective after the rule could be approved by a law enacted after publication of the notice of adoption. This change to expedited rulemaking procedure replaces the current effective date, which is the date of publication in the state register. The DNR's expedited rulemaking projects can usually be completed in 6 to 12 months, depending upon the case and the employee workloads. This change would triple the time of an expedited rulemaking process. This change would eliminate the entire point of having an expedited rulemaking procedure. An expedited process is best suited for non-controversial rulemaking, where we have already done the participatory work that is best suited for non-controversial rulemaking, the participatory work with our stakeholders, where they have high expectations for the DNR to get the rules finished and implemented in a very timely fashion. The expedited process also allows us to streamline and eliminate outdated regulations more quickly, again, where we've got high expectations for our stakeholders to get things maintained and up to date. In fact, in 2015, the DNR requested and received expanded authority to use that expedited permanent rulemaking procedure more broadly with our game and fish rulemaking so that we could be even more responsive in that work. With the ability to do expedited rulemaking, we can be even more nimble when doing regulatory action that's appropriate to prevent and control wildlife disease, to manage and our prohibited and regulated invasive species and unregulated non-native species, and to carry out our other game and fish management work in consultation with our licensed hunters, anglers, and other permittees. And I do want to make sure that you are aware that the expedited permanent rulemaking procedure in 14.389 is different from all the other rulemaking procedures in one important respect. It can only be used by an agency with express authorization from the legislature. I recently searched the 2016 statutes on the revisor's website and turned up only 18 such express authorities to use the expedited rulemaking procedure. These changes that would immediately affect any rulemaking that's currently in progress, these changes that are proposed in this bill. And regarding the amendment that was proposed today for discussion, it appears that it would unduly delay exempt rulemaking for all agencies. And exempt rulemaking is designed for administrative efficiency. And finally, I would say that the case has not been made that rulemaking under Chapter 14 is broken, and that is part of our concern among all of the agencies about this bill. And with that, I would turn it over to our staff attorney for a couple of additional comments.
Ms. Carlson, thank you for your thorough comments this morning. Ms. Biona, Ruthven, if you want to go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Fiona Riven, R-U-T-H-V-E-N. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I will be brief. I just wanted to raise some concerns with the ruling which is proposed for the legislative approval requirements. These requirements may violate constitutional separation of powers and presentment principles by permitting the legislature to veto proposed rules simply through legislative inaction. I would note that Governor Pawlenty vetoed a bill with similar provisions in 2003. In his veto message, Governor Pawlenty noted that such a bill would essentially shift authority for conducting rulemaking from the executive branch to the legislative branch, vitiate agencies' ability to effectively enact rules, and needlessly delay rule adoption because of the timing of the legislative sessions. Governor Pawlenty noted that the legislative branch has ample ability to change or amend rules through legislation without disrupting the rulemaking process. Similar concerns were raised by Governor Dayton in a 2012 veto. Finally, I would note that past Senate counsel have raised constitutional concerns related to such legislative oversight of a rulemaking process. In a prior memo, Senate counsel noted that the separation of powers and delegation of powers concepts may be interpreted to prohibit the legislature from delegating quasi-legislative rulemaking powers to an executive branch agency while reserving veto or suspension power to itself. Similar concerns, that was in 1977, and similar concerns were raised by Senate counsel in a 2003 memo to the Rules Task Force. Those are the only issues I would like to raise.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions of the two testifiers? Is there anyone from the public who'd like to offer testimony today? Anyone else from the public? Seeing none, Representative Nelson, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like a question of Judge Poost. She's here from the OLA.
Good morning and welcome. State your name for the record, who you represent, and we'll ask Representative Nelson to then ask his question.
Good morning. My name is Tammy Poost. I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Thank you for having me here today.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is in this bill, this, and the way I look at this, we're turning it on its head. Currently, the rules, we pass bills and we put different type of rulemaking in the bills, from expedited to exemptions of rulemaking. And all those rules, I get those reports from your office. All those rules are reviewed that are promulgated, and then the legislature currently has the next legislative session, and we can overturn those rules. Am I correct in that,
Judge?
Mr. Chair and members, let me take you back a little bit to the concept of delegation. The power that an agency has to pass rules comes from you. The legislature gives them the power to pass rules. If you don't want agencies to have the power to pass rules, you can simply say you don't have the power to pass rules. Statutorily, under Chapter 14, which Representative Pugh has already mentioned, you have a process, the legislature has passed a process, that no agency can pass a rule but for going through the standard process. One of the pieces of that process is it comes to OAH, and an administrative law judge looks at every proceeding to decide Is it necessary? Is it reasonable? And does it fit with the delegated authority that you, the legislature, gave them? I just pulled some numbers from last year of the 63 proceedings that went through OAH last year. We had at least 8, which is over 10%, that we found to be not either necessary or reasonable or outside the box of the authority that you gave them and had to send them back and say, agencies, you don't have the authority to do that. So you do, as the legislature, have the authority to look at rules now, and you have the authority at the front end to decide who should and who shouldn't promulgate rules on what subject matters.
Representative Nelson.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Poost, but we did on the back end also have the authority, if the rule gets put in place, that we can pass legislation to overturn that rule or change that rule. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair and members, you always have the authority the next legislative session to do whatever you want in passing statutes. So if an agency has passed rules that you don't like, you can pass a statute saying we don't like that and this is what, in fact, the law is going to be. And the statute will always trump the rule if you make it, if you make a statute on the same topic matter. I believe that's what Representative Hughes' bill affects, in that this bill actually says every time an agency passes a rule, it's going to come back to this committee. And with all due respect, I really appreciate Representative Pugh asking to have this bill laid over for some further consideration, because I have two issues that I think that I know in the conversations we've had before are two issues of timing that I think the committee needs to be aware of. One thing you need to understand is that whenever you pass a rule, if you want to get rid of a rule, you have to go through the same process as to make a rule. So the two timing issues are, one, if you decide that there's a rule out there that's too much of a burden on some sort of industry and you want it to stop, you wouldn't be able to affect that until there was a next legislative session. So you might be delaying the change of that for about 7 months. The other issue of timing is that this committee would need to hear those 63 different proceedings that went through OAH. Constitutionally, you only have 120 legislative days. I don't know how many days your committee has, but I think it would take a chunk of your time. So I'm certainly happy to continue to work with Representative Pugh and anybody else who's interested to figure out how you actually do approach this issue, which is a legitimate issue. Is there too much government regulation or not, and what do you do about it?
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, with that, I think we'll just – I think we got a rundown. If it's going to be laid over, I'm assuming we're going to – at some point talk about this and maybe look at the whole rulemaking process again. It's good to review that from time to time, and when we have new legislators, it's good to have them to go through the process. So,
and this is a remnant from our day that we did talk about rulemaking because of timing and things. We didn't get a chance to get to it, and Representative Pugh had been doing some prep work, and she wanted obviously the chance to have that as well. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this question goes to Judge Pugh. I know the folks up here from the DNR had mentioned a veto from a previous governor who cited a constitutionality issue. Could you touch on maybe your thoughts on that? I hate to put you on the spot.
Judge?
Mr. Chair and members, I actually did a memo to this committee a couple years ago that I'd be happy to refresh and bring back to you, but I will have to admit to you, my age in life, I could not cite it to you, and as a good lawyer, I wouldn't want to make that up. So I'm happy to provide you that information, but I don't have it here today.
Probably in the reverse order. As a good lawyer, you don't want to make comment without
exactly.
Reviewing your records.
Proving the first, though.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes back to the previous attorney's comments where she said there were one of the governors said that there was a separation between the legislative and the executive. But if it's the legislature that made the original bill, how is it that we would not be able to determine how that's implemented?
Judge?
Mr. Chair and members, depending on what authority the legislature originally delegated, you can get into constitutional problems with whether you are stepping over the line in the separation of powers between your branch and the executive branch. However, if the power originated with the legislature, then the legislature can take back that power. So in each and every case, we would have to look at where did the authority come from, who passed it, Is it a federal authority that came to you and then through you, or is it something that the Minnesota legislature thought up on its own? So, again, it's not a topic that we can sort of come up with a blanket statement on. Council is absolutely correct. Constitutionality is an issue that you need to be really aware of and careful about as you crafted any bill.
Representative Mason, follow-up?
No, thank you very much.
Seeing no other committee questions or anyone from the public wishing to testify on the matter, anyone wishing to testify on the matter from the public? Representative Pugh will give you final comments before we lay the bill over.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do have a few remarks, and I want to thank all of the testifiers and Judge Boost for being here and clarifying this. This is a very complicated issue, and I look forward to working with anyone who's interested in bringing some clarity, any ideas forward, so that we can give more transparency and accountability to the process. You know, rulemaking has been in the news on a national level recently, with President Trump having signed his one-in, two-out order on rulemaking. And prior to President Trump, President Obama, his administration released, for example, there was a headline of 3,400 regulations in 2014. A lot of these rules are longer than the actual statutes and bills that brought them. And I think that, you know, per our testifier who was here ever so briefly on Thursday for one of the other two rulemaking bills, the public is looking for some more transparency and accessibility to government. And since rulemaking has the full force and effect of law, I think it's very important that we bring some more oversight. So I look forward to continuing to work with committee members and anyone who's interested in doing that. Thank you.
Representative Pugh, with that, I'll lay over the bill, and I'll ask you when you come back and return to be the chair, because I have the next bill up, and we've got two left after that.
Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to move House File 1377 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. And Madam Chair, I also have an author's amendment that I'd like to take up at this time as well.
Okay.
It is the A3 amendment.
Yes, and Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to speak to the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, thank you. We were in the Commerce Committee earlier this week with the bill, and one of the things that we discussed would be helpful in looking to put our stakeholder group together that we'll talk about in the bill was to also add the Association of Minnesota Counties to bring them as a part of the working group. And so what I'd like to do is move the A3 amendment, which would include them as a part of the stakeholder group identified in the bill.
Chair O'Driscoll, I've been made aware that we may need to take a pause. We have the incorrect engrossment of the bill.
Oh, okay.
Or the amendment of the bill. So our page...
Madam Chair, if you'd like to do this procedurally, just lay this bill over and then move to the next two bills so that we can keep things moving, but that would be fine as well.
Yes.
Just lay it on the table, Madam Chair.
Oh. Okay.
So, yes, I will lay over House File...
Just lay it on the table, Madam Chair.
House File 1377 on the table.
And then, Madam Chair, do you want to proceed to the next one so we can see about getting this matter resolved?
And our next bill will be Representative Marquardt, House File 1756. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, Representative Marquardt. I'll state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'm State Representative Paul Marquardt from District 4B, and I appreciate you and the committee hearing this bill. And House File 1756 is a bill that will help assure that taxpayers, when they have someone do their returns, that they're done accurately. I mean, right now as we speak, people are filing their income tax returns, and last year about 1.7 million people around the state, taxpayers, hired someone to do their tax returns. And as you know, your tax return is probably the most personal information thing that you release to the government or anyone. And so as a taxpayer, you have that expectation and faith that when you hire someone to do that, it's going to be done correctly. The right amount paid, the right amount refunded, and everything else. Most of the time it works that way. Some of the times it doesn't. And so what this bill does, and the Department of Revenue has worked, and I want to commend the Department of Revenue and the Certified Public Accountants community for coming together on this bill, but what they have done is focused, targeted bill that kind of goes towards the bad actors, those who deliberately and fraudulently file false returns on behalf of the folks that they're serving. And so what this bill does, it creates some clarification. It also includes not only individual taxpayers, but businesses. That's new. But it creates transparency, creates some information where if you're a taxpayer, you can kind of see who are the good actors and the bad actors and so forth. And so we have Terry Steenblatt from Department of Revenue here to
talk more.
Representative Marquardt, I neglected to move your bill, and so I would like to do that at this time, and then we'll proceed to your testifier.
And Madam Chair, I would like to move the House File 1756 be re-referred to civil law. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative Nelson moves House File 1756 to civil law. All right, we're going to proceed with testimony.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Terry Steenblatt, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And I would like to thank Representative Marquardt for bringing this bill forward today. In your packet, you have something that looks like this. Yours will be in color. I'm going to walk through this a little bit to help explain the bill and what the problems are right now. Hopefully you have it. As Representative Marquardt stated, this bill is really focused at the unethical and the fraudulent tax preparer that's out there. And unfortunately, that problem is continuing to grow. We've conducted many reviews and audits related to questionable and fraudulent behavior of a preparer. And the victims of these crimes are often members of the elderly, low-income, and non-English-speaking populations. And sadly now I see several examples a day of preparers who are participating in either fraudulent or unethical behaviors. For example, we had one preparer who was recently charged with 53 felonies based on an investigation and an audit that we completed. So as we look at part of the problem is, again, focused on those that are acting unethically and fraudulently. This bill is not aimed at licensed tax professionals. So it does not cover professionals such as the CPAs, the lawyers, or the IRS enrolled agents. And the reason for that is because they are already administered or monitored through the organizations that they are a part of. Now, I will say if for some reason they been convicted of a crime or removed from one of those associations, then this bill would apply to them. There are also some gaps in the present law that we're trying to accomplish with this particular bill. In today's world, the commissioner has the authority to tell somebody that they cannot represent somebody in front of the Department of Revenue, but we do not have the authority to tell them they cannot submit returns. So what that means is we can say, you know, you shouldn't be representing taxpayers in front of the agency, but you can still submit tax returns. So this bill aims to eliminate, if we need to, the ability for a fraudulent or an unethical preparer from submitting tax returns to the agency. This bill provides some new enforcement tools that help us combat this problem as well by allowing the commissioner to order a cease and desist, to issue a cease and desist order. And then if the violation continues after we tell a preparer to stop participating in that fraudulent or unethical behavior, then they would be subject to some additional fines. It does allow for the implementation of a $500 penalty for what we call a ghost preparer. So this bill would require you, if you're a preparer, to put your preparer tax identification number on your return. If you don't do that and you're charging people and you're filing multiple returns, then you would be subject to a $500 fine. It expands and coordinates the standards that we are requiring of an unlicensed preparer. So things like you cannot intentionally put fraudulent information on a return. That would be an example of expanding that type of standards. It expands and clarifies when the department can publish a name. So in today's world, we can publish a name for a very short window of time. Unfortunately, what happens is a lot of preparers are now filing right now, and they may have been removed from the website based on the time frame we have in place. So this expands it to a 3-year time frame, which aligns with what other agencies do in this particular area. And then finally, as Representative Marquardt stated, it applies to both individual and business tax returns that are filed, because preparers that are unethical and fraudulent file not only individual, but they file business tax returns as well. So I just want to briefly touch on what this bill does not do. This bill does not create a statewide licensing system for preparers, but it does support the preparer who is ethical and holds the preparer who is not ethical accountable. It does not increase any compliance costs for the preparers. So there are no additional costs for a preparer as a result of this bill. And finally, this bill does not ignore the increasing problem of the returns that preparers have filed. And as Representative Marquardt stated, taxpayers do put their faith in someone. They've been led to believe that individual is going to take their very personal information and is going to treat that in a professional manner and file an accurate return for them. And this bill acts to protect taxpayers from that unethical and fraudulent behavior. And with that, we'll stand for questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Steenbach. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify to the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gino Fragnito, and I'm the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society. And we want to thank the Department of Revenue for working and developing this bill and working with us over the last few months to come up with a solution that we think is moving in the right direction, and also like to thank Representative Marquardt for introducing it. Regulation of unlicensed paid preparers has been a topic that's been around and continues to be discussed in many states and at the federal level. And the underlying issue in most of these discussions is what to do about deceptive, predatory, unethical, and sometimes fraudulent actions by these unlicensed tax preparers. For many of these unethical individuals, it's not a lack of knowledge, but it's rather intentionally misapplying the knowledge that they do have. Minnesota currently has a structure and statutes in place regulating the accounting practice of licensed professionals, and the federal government has a structure in place to regulate those who practice before the IRS, but neither the IRS nor the state currently regulates the practice of those unlicensed preparers. CPAs, attorneys, and enrolled agents, while must pass exams and complete annual continuing education requirements, are regulated under various different state and federal laws, as Commissioner Steenbach alluded to, and would be exempt from this. But having said that, our reason for supporting this comes down to a question of public protection and the protection of a taxpayer's personal financial information. There are many unlicensed preparers who do the right thing, but unfortunately, the actions of a few have reflected negatively on the entire preparer community, and those individuals should not be allowed to prepare and practice as tax practitioners. We support House File 1756 and the Department's efforts to add additional protection for those individuals who need assistance in trying to comply with, sometimes very hard to understand, and many times difficult to interpret tax law. This legislation will give the Department additional tools to address a problem that will continue to grow as attempts to steal financial information and personal identities increase, and the filing of fraudulent tax returns increases. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Elwood, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'm just pleased here to be sitting with Representative Marquardt to support his bill. I can tell you Legal Aid does have many clients who have had problems with unlicensed paid tax preparers. We work with them all the time, and our clients are not only particularly vulnerable, but I think somewhat disproportionately targeted by this group of taxpayers. So anything that we can do to improve the enforcement and the oversight and reduce the amount of problems in this area, we certainly support and thank Representative Marquardt for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Elwood. Are there any other members of the public who would like to speak to this bill?
No.
Any other member questions? Any member questions? No. Okay, Representative Marquardt, would you like to make a few final remarks?
Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for hearing the bill. And it fills in the gaps for, you know, when you file your income tax with very personal information, making sure things get right. So I appreciate all the help and the testifiers also, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. So Representative Nelson removes his motion for House File 1756 to be re-referred to civil law. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The bill is on its way to civil law. Thank you. Have a great Saturday. Okay. Next up, we will be hearing House File 1934, Representative Dean. No, Representative Dean's file. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. Please just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Raymond Dean.
Madam Chair, we need to move the bill. Need to move the bill?
Yeah, I'm not
yes,
on this committee.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I move House File 1934 be referred to State Government Finance. Proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, House File 1934 is actually in response to the legislative auditor's report in regard to the stadium facility authority, and recommendation number two was to have the suites actually be used, the two suites that the authority has used to, that they be used for charitable organizations or provided for charitable organizations to take advantage of it. And what this does, it says that they need to make those suites available for nonprofit charitable organizations under 501c3 of the IRS for at least half of the NFL events. I believe that there's a companion that's moving in the other body already that includes similar language to this. So I would ask for your consideration, and hopefully we can get this to the floor quick.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Dean. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify to this bill? Seeing none, are there any members who would like to speak to the bill? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment to the bill.
Representative Peterson moves the A2 amendment, and would you like to speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Basically, this amendment just changes the word NFL to stadium, and since this is the people's stadium, it would seem to make sense that we would offer opportunities for the public of charitable organizations to be able to use the stadium for half as the time as well. Thank you.
Representative Dean?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, I'm sort of curious why this is coming forward after the recommendation was regards to the NFL and the use of the suites during the NFL primarily. So I'd love to hear your comments, and I'm guessing other committee members would too.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dean. Well, I mean, basically, I already said it. It's you know, why just limit opportunities for kids and other people who maybe wouldn't have the means to be able to afford to go to the stadium? There's a variety of different events that happen at the U.S. Bank Stadium, you know, arts, sporting facilities other than just football, and why not open it up for the rest of the things that happen at the stadium now?
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would, I think this makes what I'm proposing a lot more complicated. I think monitoring all of the events throughout the year that take place at the stadium becomes now very much an onerous process for the Sports Facility Authority. If the committee so chooses to add this amendment, they so choose to do that, it just is going to begin to muddle this up. There are significant bills in regards to the use of the suites at the stadium by the Sports Facility Authority, and I think that this could become a contentious issue as we continue to move forward, and we can continue to pile on, or we can continue to just sort of try to move this along the lines of what the auditor's recommendation was.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean. And, you know, I was just hoping to offer some opportunities for other people to go to concerts and things like that, but I don't want to mess up the pathway of your bill. So with that, I will withdraw my amendment.
Okay. Representative Peterson withdraws her amendment. Representative Nelson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I was just going to note that according to, from what I remember of the use agreement, the reason we can't sell the Viking games is it's in the use agreement with the Vikings, but the stadium authority would be able to at current time sell access to those suites, thank you, for other events, and that actually would bring money in to help pay down the debt on the stadium. So, but the amendments have been drawn, so don't need to worry about it.
Representative Dean.
Just no comment. I'm more than happy, Madam Chair, more than happy to sit down and chat. Mm-hmm. Representative Peterson.
Representative Nash.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Nash moves the A1. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would hope that Representative Dean would welcome this amendment. You know, one of the things that we saw both in this committee and in State Gov Phi is that there was really a lack of good data that was generated around who was in these suites, and that's the reason to move this amendment, because I think being the People's Stadium, we want to have a record of who all's been there so that we can continue that accountability that I think we all agree is important. So thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nash. And although I really appreciate this, I'm not so sure it should be on my bill. I think it should actually be on Chair Anderson's bill. It's most of the larger issue overall on the issues of holding the Sports Authority accountable.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nash.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Dean, are you in favor of this language becoming enacted eventually?
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, this language is not something that I am intimidated by. I actually think it's good language. I'm just not sure that it belongs on my bill.
Well, Madam Chair, I would love to see you accept this, because I think it is a good faith effort. It really helps the people of Minnesota understand. And I've heard from a lot of folks that say, you know, let's open it up to charities to use. So I think that in principle it's a good idea, but I think that they also ask for some accountability.
Representative Dean?
Again, Madam Chair, this language is, I think, fine. I think it belongs on the larger bill about the stadium and the sports facilities authority.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, I think we are all in agreement on this, and I think we're kind of going back to one of our former colleagues' strategies on this, the belt and suspenders approach of Representative Kahn. trying to get this kind of language in as many places as we can to hopefully affect the final outcome of this. And I was hoping that maybe we would be able to take this language today. We would really like to see it as well.
Representative Dean?
Madam Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this would be good language also. I think going forward, if it's on here, it's not going to affect this one, this bill, and if it gets put on the other bill, it would be great also. If we'd had this language in effect under the previous stadium we had there, they also had suites that were being used by the Sports Facilities Commission there, but there's no record of them, and we can't go back and look at those. During this controversy about, and see who had used those in the past. So this would have been good language to have in the past. I think it would be good language having going forward.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dean.
So just in comment to the A1, it seems to apply specifically to the charitable organizations, and I would love to see something that's actually much broader, and I believe that maybe Chair Anderson does that. I hope that this doesn't scare away some charitable organizations to actually want to attend games or at the stadium. But, you know, if you all decide this is good language, I'm more than happy to take it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nash?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Nelson. You know, I think we're in agreement here, and you and I have sat on committees for a long time together. And I think that the driving the transparency is a good thing. So I appreciate that and appreciate this.
All in favor? Excuse me. Yes, Representative Mason. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question, and I'll ask the author this. If the intent is to make it available to charitable organizations, my guess is in many cases this would probably involve children and other individuals who probably we should not be making their names public. Is that an accurate statement?
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, I would assume that because of disclosure, anybody that's a minor may not, their names may not be required to be disclosed.
So that would mean they'd be automatically exempted?
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, I'm not, even though I'm on civil law and data, I'm not 100% sure we need to.
Representative Dean, yes.
I'm going to call a friend right now.
Yes, Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, just to clarify this language, it doesn't actually require the names of the individual people that attend the event. What this requires is just that the name of the organization, the date that they receive the access to the suite, and then the number of people in attendance is required to be public, but it doesn't require identification of the individual people that showed up.
Yes. Representative Kwan?
No, same
clarification. Okay. Any other member questions or comments? Okay, we will vote on the A1, and all in favor of the A1 amendment, Representative Nash's amendment, say aye.
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 And all opposed, nay. So the motion to adopt the amendment is passed. And any other member comments? Representative Dean, then, final remarks.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and I hope that you will all vote in support of 1934.
So, Representative, here's my motion to move your bill to state government finance. All in favor, say
as amended.
Thank you. Oh, yes, Representative Joachim, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, I'm just a little confused. Is there a reason why it would go to state government finance?
Representative Joachim, I have been informed that state government finance has requested this bill.
So although it doesn't have any financial implications, it still has to go there? Because we're the policy division, so I guess I'm a little confused. We've done that with a few of the bills today, and I hadn't brought up that question, but maybe
Representative Nelson can explain.
Chairs have great deference or great authority to ask for bills they want to see in their committee, and
I think our overall general rule is that anything that makes it farther from passage that takes precedence over expediency to the floor. So if she wants to have it there, that keeps it farther from being passed, as opposed to going to the general register from this committee. So that would be with our normal procedures that we have in the legislature as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Joaquim and Representative Nelson. So I renew my motion that House File 1934, as amended, be re-referred to State Government Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Representative Dean, your bill is on its way to State Thank Government you, Finance. All right, Chair O'Driscoll, I will move that House File 1377 be brought off the table.
Madam Chair, thank you. Again, we do now have the correct engrossment down here. We don't want to have any technical issues because I think this is a great consumer protection bill, and we want to make sure that we're taking care of the residents here in the state of Minnesota. So again, kind of, if you will, on the restart, I move that House File 1377 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy after today. And now that it's back formally in front of the committee, I will offer once again the A3 amendment. Reviewing my comments from earlier, and actually this is the part that's within the purview of the committee. We are asking in this bill to have a stakeholders group or task force put together to look at the issues that we'll talk about in the bill. And we noticed in Commerce that we wanted one other group, and that's why we have the amendment here today to include the Association of Minnesota Counties, among other stakeholders who would be involved with this. And so, Madam Chair, with that, I stand for questions on the A3 amendment.
Members, any questions? And I see there's a member.
Chair, do we want to move the amendment and
yes.
Vote?
Yes, I move the Chair O'Driscoll moves the A3 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The motion passes.
Madam Chair, yes, before we get to testifiers and others who are here today to talk about the bill, I'd like to just give a little bit of a background on this. The bill deals with a concept called PACE, and PACE deals with energy efficiency related improvements that people may be making in their homes. And we have with their property, and I'll parse it down into two different groups, commercial, industrial, and then residential. In the state of Minnesota, we've been using PACE-related improvements on commercial and industrial property, and it's been going fairly well. There's also a provision in Minnesota law that allows it for residential. And the concerns that that I have, and I share with my bipartisan co-authors on this as well, is that we're in a situation where there really is no disclosure on how the PACE process would work and an understanding for the consumers should they participate in this. Very quickly, PACE allows a local unit of government the ability to be able to go out, sell bonds, and have the opportunity to be able to take those proceeds and with the homeowner in concert with the provider of these energy-related services, make improvements into the home. And then what the local unit of government would do is put a special assessment under Minnesota's Chapter 429, which is the local unit of government's authority to place special assessments on the property. Conceptually, I have no problem with that idea. But the underlying part that I have the concerns are that, number one, this lien for special assessments would go ahead of any other type of lien on the property, with the exception of the real estate property tax lien. So it'll go ahead of a first mortgage that was recorded on the property, a second mortgage that was recorded on the property, and any other types of liens that may be on the property in good faith. This is great if we're in an up market and the property can be sold and the assessment can be paid off. But in a down market where the property has this indebtedness against it plus the mortgage, we're putting that homeowner in a very difficult spot. And my testifiers will actually give some individual experiences and concerns that their stakeholder groups have. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to you to bring testifiers forward.
right, I see we have a testifier right at the stand. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yep. My name is Teresa Kubas. I'm with the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent 95% of the banks in Minnesota. I'm the NBA and Sports Representative O'Driscoll's House File 1377. Since we had a full hearing in Commerce, I'll kind of keep my testimony today to the stakeholder process. This bill creates a Department of Commerce stakeholder process that will allow for a thoughtful and deliberate discussion on the PACE-related issues homeowners need to understand before determining if this type of financing makes sense for them. Again, residential PACE has been on the books in statute since 2010, but has not actually been officially working. Nobody has really implemented the program, so no programs have been in place, whereas on the commercial side they have. We are concerned about the problems that California homeowners have encountered over the past few years with residential PACE programs became available in their state. They've had it on the books for a couple more years, and they didn't have the consumer protections in place, and they have been kind of, over the last couple of years, re-implementing consumer protections to address some of those concerns. We don't want to repeat the California experience here in Minnesota. Homeowners need to understand the benefits and risks of PACE financing, where an energy efficiency project is financed by adding an assessment to a homeowner's property bill that is paid back over time. If homeowners are not well-informed at the time they take out a PACE loan, they may be surprised and frustrated by the amount their property taxes increase to pay back the loan, potential delays or even cancellations when they want to sell their home due to a buyer's unwillingness to assume responsibility for paying back the PACE loan, which is attached to the property. And then the first lien position of the PACE loan may reduce the pool of eligible buyers because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's unwillingness to purchase mortgages for a property with a PACE lien. On that issue particularly, that's obviously a big issue to Minnesota bankers. The financing structure creates additional risk for the mortgagee. PACE loans create a retroactive liability on the property ahead of the existing first lien mortgage, which the mortgage holder neither knows about nor consents to. The lender has no knowledge and no say in the subsequent additional risk, further the risk is enhanced because PACE loans require minimal underwriting, whereas the majority of the conventional mortgages must document the borrower's ability to repay. So we do believe that kind of slowing down the process in Minnesota and bringing together stakeholders on all sides of this, really kind of get the consumer protections in place before we really move forward with the program is the best route to go. So thank you.
Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Kubas. Chair O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, just again to emphasize, as Ms. Kubas said, we had a robust discussion on the parts and the process and the program. Her background is to help the committee understand as we weigh in on the idea of whether or not we should put together that stakeholder work group. And so that's basically going to be the parts of Section 2, Subdivision 2, what the group would look like, who the stakeholder group would be, that would review this and bring the recommendation back to the legislature. So, again, that's the part that's within the purview straight away with this committee.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. And I see we have another testifier. Please, again, state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. We're here to support House File 1377 and thank Representative O'Driscoll for carrying it. I think everyone supports bringing a market-based loan option for consumers to choose efficiency and cleaner energy. But this product is really not like any other traditional loan, and as such, it has none of the statutory protections or oversight that apply to a traditional loan. Further, it is equity-based lending, which should raise alarm bells generally. And as Ms. Kubas pointed out, I think the California experience is sufficiently concerning to warrant the stakeholder process that is the central part of this bill in this committee's purview. So finally, I just say it's important to proceed slowly and carefully to figure out what conditions and what statutory consumer and marketplace protections are necessary to allow residential PACE to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Chair O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, that concludes all the testifiers that I have, and when it's appropriate to make comments, if there are other testifiers, I'd be happy to do that as well.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Are there any other members of the public who would like to speak to this bill? Yes, please take the testifier stand, announce your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Erickson, I work for United Strategies and I'm on contract with Renovate America. Julie Padilla couldn't be here today. She is my client, so I apologize. So please be gentle. If there's any technical questions, I'll refer them to Representative O'Driscoll. Renovate, Ms. Kubas is correct. We have had residential PACE on the books here since 2010, and for a number of reasons, no one has entered the marketplace. Renovate America is a residential PACE company and is interested in coming into this marketplace, and they've been engaging with the Department of Commerce and other stakeholder groups since 2015 to take kind of a broad approach to this to this practice and to see what the statute looks like and if there needed to be any changes made to that. At its core, Renovate America is a software company, and what it does is it's created software that they give to local contractors, so when your furnace breaks, for example, you're allowed, your contractor will come over, give you a bunch of options on how to pay for that furnace, and Renovate America's Hero program might be one of those financing options. In just over 5 years, residential PACE has gone from concept to practice and has enabled homeowners and businesses to make more than $3 billion in investments in their properties to lower their energy costs. It's important to note that over 128,000 homes have been improved through the voluntary PACE financing mechanism, and not a single foreclosure due to PACE assessment has occurred. I'm not sure if you have you might have two handouts in your packet that address this.
We did just get two.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And if you get a chance, we don't need to go over them right now. As with all new products and industries, as these things come into fruition and grow, there are problems that emerge, and these companies have been addressing them. To that end, the Department of Energy on a federal level has come out with a very comprehensive set of consumer protections that we believe should either be in statute or program, and PACE Nation, the industry association, has also endorsed those, and we would be happy to continue to work with all stakeholders and putting some kind of consumer protection either in statute or in a program wherever is most appropriate. Our overriding concern on Chair O'Driscoll's bill in his own committee is that we're nervous that this program might just go away. If there is no resolution to the second round of consumer or the second round of stakeholders, there's nothing in this that allows for this program to blink back on. So what we would respectfully ask is that as we continue this discussion, as it continues to move forward, that we are excited to sit down again and go through a stakeholder process to work on consumer protections, but that we can come to some kind of understanding that this program just won't go away.
Mm-hmm. Chair O'Driscoll.
If there's any member questions or other people from the public, otherwise I would like to just respond and make some closing comments if I could.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify to this bill? No. Seeing none, are there any member questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair O'Driscoll. The way I read this bill is that we're going to blink this program off, create a stakeholder group to look at the issues to make sure that we don't have what was determined as issues that would happen in other states that have instituted this. And in my understanding, there's only a couple states that are doing this, one that just recently put it on board. And then when this group comes back next January to us, the legislature, and say, this is the report, this is what we recommend, then legislation would be brought forward to put those safeguards into law, so that, and then the program would go forward. Is that how I'm reading this bill?
Chair O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that is correct.
So, Madam
Representative
Chair,
Nelson.
So, Madam Chair, I know I was here when this bill was passed. So the program was passed originally. From my understanding, a lot of companies have used it. Commercial property owners have used it and have been a success. And I know there are different issues that homeowners have. They may not have the legal staff and engineers and whatnot that can help them and help them making decisions, especially as was said here, the time when somebody's furnace breaks down and now you're confronted with this. You don't have the time to look into all the
idiosyncrasies of the program. I don't think it's a bad bill, Madam Chair, and I think we should move forward with it.
Mm-hmm. Chair O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, my closing comments are this.
Very good.
First of all, this bill is not about my opposition to the concept for use of PACE. We just came through a housing crisis. My 35-plus years of experience in the real estate business, I've seen an awful lot of different things and seen an awful lot of upside and downside. Sitting on the Commerce Department listening to consumers who said that they wish that they would have had more disclosure, more information, this could be the next potential housing crisis if we don't have proper disclosure so folks who are using this know how it works and know their obligations under here. One other thing I'd like to mention is Ms. Erickson said that she's not aware of any foreclosures as a result of PACE loans on the property. Again, my 30-plus years of experience in the real estate industry tell me that lenders will go in and pay off that loan and pay off the taxes because they take priority over the mortgage on the property. Well, the PACE loan may be $15,000, pick a number. The mortgage may be $75,000, $80,000, $100,000-plus. The lender's trying to protect themselves and the investment that they have with the homeowner. This greatly, greatly could affect the availability and affordability of housing in our state and across the country if we don't to do something on this. Other states are starting to see some issues. It's good for us to hit the pause button to make sure that our consumers know about this. As a matter of fact, at the federal level, we have a piece of legislation called Dodd-Frank that really increased the amount of disclosures and slowed the real estate process down. Why would we want to put something else in here in Minnesota that could be a negative for consumers? I feel this strongly, and I don't usually do this, but I'm going to ask for a roll call vote on this because I think consumer protection is extremely important to the people in the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Chair O'Driscoll asks for a roll call. Will we prepare the roll?
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Members, I'm just clarifying the motion is to take a call for a roll call.
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1377 as amended be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy and like a roll call.
Yes. So Chair O'Driscoll calls for a roll call on House File 1377 to be re-referred as amended, re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy, and calls for a roll call. We'll take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Still yes.
Pugh?
And yes.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton? Freiberg?
Pass.
Halverson? Jessup? Lee?
Pass.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
Yep.
Nelson?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Yes.
Samstead?
Yes.
Swadzinski?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Uwakim?
Yes.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Lee?
Yes.
On a vote of 16-0, the motion passes and the bill is on its way to Jobs and Energy.
Madam Chair, thank you, members. Just thank you as well for being here with us today. We took care of a lot of business. That's going to help our committee schedule next week. And we'll have some more information out today about what the first part looks like, but it is the first week of deadlines. So thank you again and have a good weekend.
And with that, our committee is adjourned.